This is Richard Verone, and I'm continuing my interview with Mr. Tom Esslinger. Today is August 26, 2003. It's a little after 8:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. And Mr. Esslinger, you are in Lake Manassas, Virginia. Why don't we pick up, sir, where we left off? We discussed in detail some of your operations and things about your experience with Indian Company and Mike Company working out of Camp Evans. I wanted to know, you described one incident, your first incident with combat. Could you describe some of the missions, memorable incidents, anything that come to mind when you think back about that time between September and December 1967?
Yeah, I described the general day-to-day missions, and they were fairly routine. I think I mentioned the fairly lengthy patrol and so forth through the Cobitantan Valley in November when it was raining.
That, yes, sir.
That was kind of memorable. There was one other one. The troops over there occasionally engaged in what they called a county fair.
Mm-hmm.
This involved a village near Route 1, south of Camp Evans. I think it might have been called Mishan, M-Y-C-H-A-N-H.
Mm-hmm.
What that involved was, starting out as a combat mission, what we would do is we actually ran a fairly sizable patrol through that area just to sort of get a good close look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of days later, under cover of darkness, we slipped back in. I think two companies were involved, and put a cordon around the village at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the morning, went into the village and checked out everybody, tried to figure out whether there were any signs of Viet Cong sympathizers or actually Viet Cong soldiers. And we found a fair amount of abnormal amount of supplies and a few military weapons and so forth. And we captured a few young Vietnamese that were suspects. But then as soon as that was done, we brought in the doctors and so forth and turned it into an event for the people. There was some music. And the thing was supposed to go on for a couple of days, and I think it did go on for about a day and a half before we were called out to go prepare for a bigger operation.
Okay.
And, you know, the doctors and the corpsmen provided medical care to the citizens of the village.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of funny. I was looking at a letter I wrote after that the other night,
mm-hmm.
and it reminded me. I told about this operation in the letter, and then just sort of as a throwaway line, I said one child did die from a reaction to a penicillin shot,
mm-hmm.
but otherwise it was a great thing. You know, and it sort of reminded me of even that early in my tour, the sort of a hardening of our attitude toward the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
I've often reflected on how we took a group of pretty normal, pretty well-balanced Americans over there, and within a fairly short period of time, we had all developed this very hardened attitude toward the Vietnamese, particularly the enemy, but even the people that were supposedly on our side, although we didn't have that much contact with them when we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we treated them with courtesy, but in our hearts and in our minds, I don't think we thought of them as equal human beings. You know, they were small, they were a different color, they were spoke a different language, they had different culture, they had different customs. Plus, we were in a position where if we came across any of their countrymen who we regarded as enemy,
mm-hmm.
we were prepared to kill them. And as we went further along, and particularly as you started getting into situations where we were exposed to booby traps,
mm-hmm.
which really, as I indicated before, was very frustrating, and there was nobody to strike back at when you sort of suspected that any Vietnamese you saw might have been the one that set the booby trap. It really did just harden our attitude toward them. I remember one time we were going through a jungle area after it had been hit by a napalm strike a couple
mm-hmm.
days later, and we found a couple of dead NVA who by that time had bloated and they'd been burned.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all laughing, and everybody was coming and taking a look at what we call crispy critters because their outside of their body was all burned, sort of black.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude at the time seemed perfectly normal and didn't really bother me. But reflecting back on it, I don't have any particular pronouncement to say about it, except I think it was fairly remarkable, the extent to which you could dehumanize the enemy. Maybe it was necessary. Maybe that was necessary in order to enable us to injure them or kill them without conscience, but it was an interesting and kind of amazing phenomenon.
Do you think that was necessary even also with the civilian population, that you had to always be on your guard, always had to be looking out, that you could only reach a certain level of comfort with these people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the reasons I went back, when I went back in 1998, was that when I left Vietnam, I had practically zero regard for the Vietnamese, for all Vietnamese. Living around Washington over the years, I was exposed to a fair number of them who had settled in this area after they left Vietnam, Vietnamese restaurants and so forth. And I actually sort of got to like them as individuals, and I sort of felt like maybe if I went back to the country, my attitude toward the Vietnamese in general would soften, and that, in fact, did happen, but to a much greater extent than I imagined, actually.
Well, can you explain that process? How did that happen? And this is something we can talk about later in the interview when you do go back and talk about what happened, but how did you make the transition internally? What happened? What shifted?
You mean when I went back?
Well, when your attitude toward the Vietnamese civilians changed.
Well, I mean, I remember there was a Vietnamese restaurant that opened, probably in the 80s sometime, I would guess, near where I lived, and we went there several times, and the woman that ran the place was very voluble, and she would come up and chat and talk and greet us as old friends, and, you know, over a period of time, we learned a little bit more about her background, and her husband was real quiet. I mean, he was around, but he never said a word except hello, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Very reticent guy. And it turned out that he had been an official of some kind in the Saigon government, and that, you know, gotten out with the boat people and so forth in 1975, although I don't think they went in a boat. I think they did better than that because I think they were probably fairly well-to-do, and they were both highly educated. And, you know, and then here they were running this little restaurant in Wheaton, Maryland. And, you know, we got to where we really liked her. They eventually closed the restaurant, and it was kind of a big disappointment to us that we sort of lost contact with her. And that happened at several other Vietnamese restaurants, and then I would run into Vietnamese just in various places in your daily life. And largely as a result of that experience, I would engage them in conversation. Occasionally I'd say a few words of Vietnamese, which pleased them. And I found out that they were great people.
Right.
You know, they were real people, and they were great people, and I was very impressed with how they, the ones like the restaurant family, had managed to accept a considerable change in their station in life, and they were doing what immigrants to this country have done for generations, which is to work hard so that they could educate their kids and buy a better future for them. And I was impressed by that. I'm always impressed by that kind of diligence. And I admired them. I admired their ability to adjust, and I admired their values. So, but I still was, I toyed with the idea of going back, and I still was reluctant to do that, and I guess we can talk about that later when we...
Yes, sir. So was it really hard to see them as people in Vietnam?
Yeah. I mean, you know, intellectually and rationally, you knew they were people, but emotionally and subconsciously, I think we regarded them as not human.
Was that common among your men?
Absolutely.
How about in general with all the soldiers you came in contact with while you were there in country?
Yeah. I mean, it was so prevalent and to such an extreme that... leaders, I certainly found it to be true, had to consciously try to ameliorate that feeling. I mean, for example, the troops were prone to, even anxious to mutilate, to cut off ears, that kind of stuff. I don't know exactly what wellspring of emotion that comes from, but it was definitely there. And somehow, and I have no idea how I was smart enough to figure this out under those conditions, but somehow or other I felt like there was a limit to which these kids could be allowed to go and still expect them to be able to readjust and come back and be a normal American person again back in our society.
You sense that they're at the time.
Yeah. And I really don't know. I mean, I'm amazed that I did and kind of proud of the fact that I did, because I certainly shared their frustration and their fury and their desire to lash out and to strike back. But I knew there was a point past which we couldn't go, and I just wouldn't let them, and they knew that, and so they didn't.
So you, can you give me an example? How would you rein them in? What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, occasionally we would come across somebody who had a necklace made of ears or teeth or, you know, those kinds of things. And the first time I saw it, I said, wow, this goes too far. And I told, I mainly communicated this kind of stuff through the staff NCOs, through your gunnery sergeant, because that's just the way the Marine Corps worked in terms of just the day-to-day control of behavior and so forth of the troops and in minor disciplinary matters. That was done within the non-commissioned ranks. Usually you would only bring a disciplinary issue to an officer if the NCO decided that they needed some sort of official punishment. But the day-to-day handling of that sort of thing was relegated to the gunnery sergeant. That was sort of understood in the Marine Corps that the gunny was the guy who sort of was the father and the schoolmaster, and he took care of that kind of stuff unless, and in many ways, you know, protected the troopers and took care of minor disciplinary matters without having it become an official part of their record and so forth. So, I mean, I took the gunnies aside and told them that wasn't happening here, and if it did, there was going to be severe repercussions.
Okay.
And usually, that was enough. I mean, you know, that level of discussion and that way of issuing edicts and so forth worked very well.
Okay. Did you ever hear of any discussion of or incidents of fracking while you were there?
None. I mean, I had not ever even heard about it while I was there. When I came back, I heard discussions about it. I mean, I did witness a few examples of what I thought was adverse troop reaction to the behavior of officers, but I certainly never heard of or even perceived that doing physical harm to them was in them. I mean, the vast majority of officers were there to accomplish a mission and look out for the troops. Occasionally you would run across one who seemed or at least projected the image of being in it for himself, you know, for decorations or promotion or whatever. The troops could pick up on that. It's amazing how quickly they could pick up on that. And in Vietnam, you got to remember now, I spent 13 months in combat, out in contact. We didn't have time for a lot of this foolishness, you know, the drugs and the alcohol and the fragging. And I mean, most of that stuff, in my experience, occurred in units that were maybe in more secure bases, and they had time to get into mischief. We didn't. I mean, from dawn to dusk every day, we were busy, and when dusk came, we were tired as hell, and we went to sleep if we could, and you know, we were busy all the time. I remember in one of my letters saying in May and June and early July, we were up under the triple canopy in west of Da Nang most of the time, and I said, you know, we went up there May 15th, and 2 days later it was July 4th. I mean, that's just the way it was. Time was fully occupied. But the troops recognized in the combat situation that the best chance they had of getting out of their life and getting home was if they had an officer who was competent, who cared about them, and most of all, was very good at the use of supporting arms, because that was, as I told you before, the major advantage we had over the enemy. And if they recognized that you were those things, then far from wishing you harm, they would go out of their way to protect you. I mean, I have many instances in which troops, you know, corporals, lance corporals would stop me and tell me that I was putting myself in an exposed position or getting too close to danger and get me out of there or try to get me out of there. Because they knew that, I mean, it wasn't that they loved me. They knew that I was their ticket home.
When did that happen?
Oh, that happened often.
Okay.
I mean,
can you give an example?
I think it's common for aggressive, hard-charging lieutenants when they first get there to want to, if not walk point, move very close to the front and get themselves to every point of action and get involved in the action.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important and it's necessary because you can't conduct a unit, you can't control an engagement if you don't know what's going on.
Right.
But you can overdo it. And let me tell you a story, not about me, but somebody else that illustrates the point.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Vietnam, it was in 1998, the trip back, it was a fairly large group. I think there were over 60 of us. And one of the guys that was along was an Episcopal minister who had parts of both his legs blown off.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, everybody got to know him very well, and he was an important, valuable part of the group. There was one other guy along who was sort of a very quiet, reserved kind of guy, and one of my friends who was along is the kind of guy who seeks out those kinds of people and goes out of his way to engage them and make them part of the group. And so my friend Jay started talking to this guy, and it turned out this guy had been a corporal, and he'd been over there, and he told us this story. He said the reason he came back, the story was one of the reasons he came back. He said that he had been in the unit in the 26th Marines and 1st Battalion 26th Marines, and I think it was Bravo Company. And they had a new lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And this lieutenant was a hard charger, and, you know, first day they went out on patrol, and he was up there walking with the point. And this went on for a week or so. And finally, this corporal took him aside and said, "Lieutenant, it's not your job to walk point. That's our job. You have to let us do our job.
Mm-hmm.
We need you. We want you back a little further." And so the next day, they went out on patrol in the rice paddy area, and the lieutenant was out walking point, and he tripped a booby trap, and it blew off both his legs.
Mm.
And they medevaced him out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And this corporal had this, you know, he recognized it was irrational, but somehow or other he felt like he had jinxed him or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt guilty about that ever since, and he just felt that if he went back and spent some time with some Marines in Vietnam, it might help him to get over it. Well, you probably know where this story's going. The Episcopal minister, when we had talked to him, he'd only been there such a short time that he didn't even remember what his unit was.
Hmm.
Well, it turned out it was the same guy.
Really?
And this was, you know, totally serendipitous that these two guys from the 3 million people who'd been to Vietnam should end up in a group of about 45 that went back together.
Wow.
And one of the things that the priest wanted to do was he wanted to go back to the spot where he had lost his leg. So
mm-hmm.
it took us a while because Jay and I were pretty good with math, but the area had changed so much that we spent most of a morning with a small bus with a group of us running around until we were able to pinpoint the area where he had gone out on patrol. And so we walked out on that rice paddy. And, I've told this story many times, and I get a little choked up every time I say it, because
mm-hmm.
The two of them sort of walked off alone.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was in his wheelchair, but he could walk with hand crutches, and with the corporal's help, they went out there to that rice paddy dike, stood there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But that's an example of what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's a very good example.
Troops wanted you to let them do their job, and they wanted you to do yours.
Right. You mentioned a couple of examples of discipline problems, not fragging type, but just problems within the ranks. Can you describe or give me those examples?
Well, probably the most, I don't know whether this is necessarily a discipline issue, but the most common form of misbehavior and the most dangerous was involved weapons. I mean, you take a bunch of 18, 20-year-old kids and you give them a bunch of loaded weapons and there's going to be accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So there were those. There would be instances in which troops weren't, it was not clear that a troop was paying full-time attention when he should be, such as on duty at night and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If a guy fell asleep and just left the whole unit exposed, that was one thing, but, you know, sort of nodding off or on a cold night huddling in a poncho or a poncho liner or maybe too low or, you know, that kind of thing that,
mm-hmm.
that was regarded as not acceptable and endangering the unit. I mean, things like that, basically.
Okay.
I mean, nothing major.
Okay. How did you deal with this issue and idea and the reality of death that was around you every day, especially as a leader, an officer?
You know, I don't know. I never thought about that. I often said, and I still believe, that most of us thought we were bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always said if I really thought there was any significant chance that they were going to kill me, I certainly wouldn't have gone. But somehow or other, I mean, I'm sure you've heard this a million times, that the human mind is a remarkable instrument. I mean, it protects you. You know, it adjusts. After a while, you sort of, I guess like we dehumanize the enemy, we sort of demythologize or dehumanize death.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you read in books, new troops coming in and watching a truckload of body bags being loaded on the plane,
mm-hmm.
you would think, my God, that would just sap any resolve and destroy your self-confidence and be emotionally unacceptable. But, you know, at that age, you're so wrapped up in what you're doing that you just sort of wall it off and move on, I think. One of the criticisms I always have of war movies, you know, they've gotten more and more realistic, but even in Saving Private Ryan,
mm-hmm.
These scenes in which a member of a small unit gets killed,
mm-hmm.
and while they're still under fire, other troops sort of gather around and mourn his passing,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't happen. And if it did happen, the commander, you know, the platoon commander would make sure it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're in combat, when the bullets are flying around, you got to deal with that. And after that's over, you can mourn the dead and
mm-hmm.
so forth. And as nearly as I could tell, every person over there that was in my unit felt the same way. I mean, it just was something that you dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't. One thing I do remember is, and this I don't understand this, and I don't offer an explanation for it, but you would run into people over there, and in talks, they would indicate that they didn't think they were going to make it. And they usually didn't.
Really?
And I don't know. I mean, one example I remember is we had this kid, PFC Irwin Sobel.
Mm-hmm.
And right after the siege started up at Quezon, we were living in sandbag bunkers that were built above ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it became obvious that those were death traps, so we quickly tunneled into the earth. But before we did that, Sobel was laying in his bunk one day inside one of those sandbag bunkers, and an enemy RPG round hit the outside just where he was lying, and it took off his left leg at the knee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had corpsmen on him right away. We stopped the bleeding. We treated him for shock. We got him medevaced within 20 minutes. And it never occurred to me that he wouldn't survive that wound.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't, and he was one of those guys who had this premonition of death and spoke about it often. And, I mean, maybe psychologically he wasn't prepared to deal with the shock. I don't know. I don't have an explanation for it, but it's a phenomenon I've remarked on many times, and I remember it well.
Is that something that you tried to suppress if guys continuously in your unit talked about, well, I know I'm going to die, I'm not going to make it, or that kind of attitude? Did you have the gunnies kind of say, hey, you know, let's...
No, we all did. I mean, everybody's reaction to that. Nobody wanted to hear that.
Right.
Because, you know, it acknowledged mortality. And like I said, the thing that got each of us individually along, I think, was the feeling that these other guys might be mortal, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't kill me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, I remember the first time I heard a bullet fly over my head, I said, oh, my God, I think I might have made a big mistake.
Before we move to Quezon, anything else you want to talk about in your time from September to December?
I mean, look here. I actually made some notes last night.
Okay.
Things I wanted to make sure I didn't miss. And I think the only thing I had from that time was the county fair.
Okay.
Yep. I think we can move on.
Okay. Well, tell me how you got to Quezon. You said, was it more of an emergency call that they needed more bodies?
Yeah,
there?
Well, we started out, we were told we were moving out of Camp Evans,
mm-hmm.
and we took a truck convoy north, and the word was that we were going out, that they were at the process then of building the McNamara Wall,
mm-hmm.
and they were putting a new series of fire bases sort of slightly in front of and in between the existing ones. And so this one was going to be called A3. It was going to be just to the west and slightly north of Kantian. And in the fall of 1967, Kantian was the hot point in the northern Marine Corps area of Vietnam, just below the DMZ. It was a small hill in terms of elevation, but it looked over the DMZ, and there was always a battalion up there, and they were always taking incoming, and there were a lot of probing attacks, and it was just the hot spot. So we all felt like, wow, we're going right up there to the DMZ. We're going to be we're going from a rice paddy war to the real war. And so we were pretty nervous. So we packed up, got the trucks, we went to Dong Ha. We got there early evening and sort of led from the airfield to places where we were going to bivouac for the night. And just about the time we got where we were supposed to pitch a camp for the night, the word came, get back on the trucks. We're going back to the landing zone. We're going to Khe Sanh. And I had told you about the reaction I had to the tactical position of Khe Sanh when we were coming through Okinawa. My thought was, oh, my God, they're attacking Khe Sanh, and we're going to fly right into the middle of it. And so we got on helicopters, and they flew us out there, and they landed us on the airstrip. And, you know, we had our flak jackets buckled, buttoned, our helmets buckled, and our weapons at high port, and we came off there ready to go to war. And I remember I was running off next to Matt Caulfield, who had been my company commander and was now the major of the S3. And, you know, we took a look around, and we saw these mountains to the north and west hovering over the airfield. And as we were running, I turned to Caulfield and said, looks like the MBM flew to me.
I knew you were going to say that.
And so we get, you know, we get off the airstrip, and life is normal. Guys are strolling down the road on their way to the enlisted man's club to have a beer, and nothing's going on. So they sort of wonder what the hell we're doing there, a whole battalion, Sparrowhawks in short notice. They didn't even have any room for us, so they sent us outside the wire to the west there a little bit and said, well, here, you guys can camp here. So that's what we did. And, you know, we built sort of an add-on, an annex to the base. We extended the wire and dug our little holes, and that's where we lived. I remember we were right next to the SOG-3, which was the one of the Army black units that flew unmarked helicopters and so forth. And that's how we got there, and that's what we did.
Okay. How long did you stay in that position before you moved out to the hill?
I stayed there until we moved out to the hill. And what we did was, we would, as we were doing before, we would run operations. I remember we ran, my company ran a couple operations out into the jungle. The terrain there was very different than what we had been used to. The mountains were a lot higher. The vegetation was a lot heavier. It was very difficult terrain to move in. We ran a patrol along the ridgeline, high ridgeline that overlooked Route 9. We were on the south side of Route 9. Route 9 was a road that ran east and west, and was the only surface link that Khe Sanh had with the rest of Vietnam. And it had actually already been compromised because it was so easy to ambush Route 9 virtually anywhere along it. And I think at that point, in late December, it had already been, in effect, closed by the NVA. And we ran a couple other operations.
What were the operations?
It was basically taking the company and patrolling, looking for signs of the NVA. We didn't know about it. You know, you talk about intelligence. I mean, now, looking back on it and having read books, I know that at a much higher level, they had learned that the normal infiltration pattern by which units coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos would turn east and infiltrate toward Quang Tri City and Hue, you know, the Marines had been in Khe Sanh from April and May of 67 all through that summer. And basically, after those hill fights, there was very little contact. What basically happened, we figured out later, was the Marines from Khe Sanh would patrol out about 4,000 meters in any direction, so the enemy just started passing them to the south about 5,000 meters away. And there was no contact. But intelligence had discovered that those patterns were changing. They were infiltrating both south and north of us and in much greater volume than they had been. And so Westmoreland was concerned about a buildup around Khe Sanh. I mean, nobody's ever quite convinced anybody else as to why Khe Sanh was there. Westmoreland says that it was there. We were basically bait because he was hoping the enemy would mass and try to do a DMBN fool, and then he could blow them away.
Mm-hmm.
And other people say we were out there to protect against infiltration in, from the Ashaw Valley into Hue and Quang Tri.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason we were there, we weren't doing much of it in the summertime, but things had changed, and I think Westmoreland thought that the enemy was massing for an attempt to take Quezon, and he was wanted to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were brought in to strengthen the base, and there were more units brought in after we were to strengthen Quezon in case there was an enemy attempt to get it.
What was the mood on the base in December 1967?
Pretty relaxed. I remember Christmas Day, sitting there in this little, we dug a little bit of hole and went down about 2 feet and then had a little poncho tent over it, and I was sitting there with a gunny, and they served us a turkey dinner, which wasn't bad, and there were some helicopters flying around playing Christmas carols and trailing red and green smoke. Troops playing softball. We played softball until the softball went into the wire where the trip wires were, so then they switched to football.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's sitting there writing letters home. It was pretty relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
That changed pretty quickly. Again, we didn't know about this buildup. We didn't even know why we were there. So we were kind of surprised when on January 2nd, we had a listening post out in front of our position.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of the night, this listening post calls in and says they've got movement, which wasn't unusual. But after a while, they said they could identify four or five or maybe more individuals moving across their front, or just to their rear, I guess, just to their right rear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the first thing we did, being my company and having had these problems before, we alerted everybody. This listening post was not mine. It was Lima Company. I think it was Lima. But we all checked to make sure we knew where all of our various patrols were so that these guys couldn't be friendlies. And they were so concerned about that that the battalion commander told the company commander of Lima to send a lieutenant and a couple of troops out there to assess the situation and make sure that we weren't running into friendlies.
Mm-hmm.
So they did. And as they moved out and got near these guys, these four or five people, they heard them moving, and they moved away from them very rapidly, and so the LP was permitted to open up on them,
mm-hmm.
and they did. And what it turned out to be was they had killed four Vietnamese officers, a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, and two majors.
Hmm.
And one guy had gotten away, and there was a blood trail, and it was clear that he had cut a map case off of the colonel and disappeared into the jungle, and they followed him, but they never found him.
Mm-hmm.
And what it turned out to be was, obviously, these NVA had a sand table or some kind of a reconstruction of the combat base out in the jungle that they were studying. And when we added that new annex onto it,
mm-hmm.
they needed to reconnoiter that. So they were walking along in the middle of the night with their maps out and walking along our wire and mm-hmm. marking where all the wire was and where the claymores were and everything else. And they had the audacity to do that. And of course, we all thought that was pretty bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you look at it now in the context of all that was going on, you recognize what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
They were obviously part of the unit that was assigned to try to take the combat base.
Right. When were you moved to the hill?
This is a long story.
Okay.
A good story. January 19th. What happened was on January 18th, I think it was, January 18th, a recon unit, Marine recon unit, was on the north side of Hill 881,
mm-hmm.
north, and they ran into a large enemy unit, and they got badly mauled, and they had a couple killed and several wounded, and it was a difficult extraction by helicopter. And I think there was one wounded guy, or maybe not. I'm not sure whether they left anybody behind, but I know they left behind a radio and some radio shackle sheets, code sheets that enabled you to know what frequency to use radios on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a major gaffe, and Captain Dabney had India Company, and they were in 881 South, which is about 2,000 meters south of 881 North,
mm-hmm.
and he was told to send a platoon out there the next day to try to get that. The shackle sheets, and they had a recon unit along to reinsert a new recon unit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they only got about halfway to 881 North, and they ran into heavy enemy resistance. And so they pulled back. And so battalion decided they were going to send a whole company out the next day. So they alerted my company and told me to get ready, and we would fly up there, and we were told, you know, our thought was we were just going to be there for a day. We actually thought we were going to be the unit that went out to 881 North. But so I went up there, and I actually left my 3rd Platoon behind. Actually, at that point, I was still the XO. But we went up there, and it turned out the battalion decided that what we would do is Mike Company would hold India Company's position on the hill, and Dabney would take, who was much more familiar with the terrain, would take all of India Company, and they would run out there to 881 North the next morning.
Okay.
And the whole battalion staff flew in. And so right after dawn on January 20th, 1968, India Company struck off the hill, had to go down this very steep slope to the north, and they got down into the valley well below the hill, and then there, in between the 881 South and 881 North, was a couple of lower-lying hills, which we named Objective 1 and Objective 2. So, in early morning, India Company started moving up these two intermediate objectives, which were basically vegetated with high elephant grass, but not trees. So we could actually see their progress from the hill. So picture this. We're on top of the battalion staff and Mike Company are on top of 881 South, which is all vegetation's been blown off, so it's very barren. And it's the last high hill in Vietnam before you get to the Laotian border, which is about 8 miles away. So from the top of this hill, you can see 20 miles into Laos, and, of course, can be seen from that distance. And between the hill and the Laotian border is a lower area of heavy vegetation, jungle. Well, Dabney's hill had a huge command bunker, big square sandbag structure with a heavy roof and so forth. So we all get up on top of the hill, on top of the bunker. I mean, there's a big flat surface up there. We're well elevated. The battalion commander, all of his staff, me, all the air observation guys, we get our folding chairs and our binoculars and get up on top of this damn bunker. And we observe this company in the attack. I mean, it's almost like some sort of training exercise. It's a beautiful day. It's sunny. The vegetation isn't that high on objectives 1 and 2, so we can watch them move up there. So we're sitting there having a great time. As they moved up to, on to objective 2, the 3rd Platoon of India Company ran into heavy resistance, and the guys who made the top of the hill were pinned down by a 50 caliber machine gun crossfire. So, and early on in that, Tom Brindley, who was the 3rd Platoon commander and who incidentally had been the XO of Mike Company and therefore was the guy I relieved when I took over Mike Company, got killed. And they were taking several wounded, and the wounded were fairly severely wounded. And, of course, there was no way they could get a helicopter in there. So a significant amount of time ensued as people, Dabney maneuvered people over there to help extract the wounded and so forth. Meantime, Mike Thomas, who was a lieutenant who had relieved me as a platoon commander of 2nd Platoon India Company, was moving up on Objective 1. And he had with him, he was on the right flank, and he had with him the recon unit that was supposed to be inserted when they got to 881 North, left behind, in other words. Well, the 50 caliber machine gun opened up on that right flank, and there were several wounded guys with the reconnaissance unit, which was down on sort of the right shoulder of the hill. So Thomas decided he had to go down and get those guys because they couldn't, they were wounded badly enough that they couldn't get him up there. So he worked his way down the hill and picked up one of these guys and carried him up the top of the hill. And I'm watching all this through binoculars. And so after he makes it back up there, he gets up and starts down the hill toward to do it again and drops like a rock. And so we, the radio call comes in that India 2 is hit. And I saw him go down. And it turns out he had taken a 50 caliber machine gun bullet right between his eyes. And so he was dead. So we, two platoon commanders have already been killed. And there are a bunch of guys wounded. So it took most of the rest of the morning and into the early afternoon to take care of the situation. We from the hill could sort of, from the top of the hill, could see all this going on, and we saw some of the tracer rounds from the 50 calibers, and we thought we knew where they were. And we called in artillery, which didn't get them, and we called in fixed-wing aircraft jets. And so we ran bombing runs for a couple of hours before we finally got these 50-caliber machine guns. They must have been dug in pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So about 1,500, our emergency medevacs have been medevac. 50-calibers enemy machine guns have been neutralized. And Captain Dabney is ready to kick ass and take names.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as he's ready to really start moving aggressively over these objectives toward 881 North, we get a call from the regimental headquarters back at Quezon. Remember, though, our whole battalion headquarters was sitting up on top of this bunker.
Mm-hmm.
That they want India Company called and brought back to the hill as soon as possible. Well, Dabney was pissed. He had been sitting there taking it all day, and now he's prepared to dish it out.
Right.
And he didn't like the idea of being called back. It took us about a half hour to cajole and order him to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So finally they come trudging back up the hill. We learned later what had happened was that at about noontime, an NVA had come walking up to the gates at Quezon with his hands on his head, waving a white flag
mm-hmm.
or a handkerchief. You may know this story. I don't know whether you do or not. It's been in some of the books.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought this guy in. They start talking to him. Turns out he's an NVA first lieutenant. And his story is that 6 months before or whatever it was, he'd been in the NVA, North Vietnamese Army, 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the executive officer of a rocket company or something. And his company and a bunch of other guys had all left North Vietnam 6 months before. They'd hiked out to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, come down through Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Just as they got into Laos, they were hit by a B-52 strike, which had about 50% casualties. The rest of them moved on. They finally get down, even with South Vietnam, so they turn east and they come into South Vietnam. And as soon as they cross the border, they get hit by another B-52 strike with a further 50% casualties.
Okay.
Now they're down 25%. And one of the casualties in the second raid is the company commander,
mm-hmm.
his company commander. And the battalion commander takes an officer who is junior to him and makes him the company commander. So at this point, this first lieutenant says, "That's it. I've had enough."
Mm-hmm.
So he puts his hands on his head and he marches up to the combat base and he's telling them all about this. He's also telling them, in addition to the whole order of battle of the entire unit that was walking down with him, he's telling them all about their plans. And he says that the plans are for his regiment to attack 881 South that night, another regiment to attack 861 that night, which is another hill outpost manned by Kilo Company between 881 South and the combat base.
Mm-hmm.
And then at dawn, they're going to attack the combat base. So, you know, the guys who were interrogating him were scratching their heads and said, "This is an awful lot of information, an awful lot of detail for a first lieutenant to know." So they're beginning to suspect that this is a plant. But everybody says, well, what do we have to lose by preparing for these attacks? If they don't occur, they don't occur.
Right.
So that was why they decided they wanted Dabney back on the hill, because they wanted maximum defensive effort that
mm-hmm.
night.
Mm-hmm.
So at about midnight, 861 is attacked in force and, in fact, overrun the night of January 20th, 21st.
Mm-hmm.
1968. 881 is 20 meters higher than 861 and maybe 1,500 meters away, something like that. We ended up firing all of our 81 millimeter mortar ammunition in support of 861 Kilo Company. And we ended up doing a lot of direct fire with 105 artillery pieces and 106 recoilless rifles to help scratch their back. We were just firing it right into the top of the hill because the enemy had overrun. The Marines were in trenches and stuff, and the enemy was the only people running around on top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the morning, you know, they called in an airstrike on top of the hill to clean off the enemy and got them out of there. 881 was never actually attacked, the theory being that all those guys that we'd blown up during the day
mm-hmm.
Was the regiment that was supposed to attack us, and so they were not effective anymore.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 in the morning, they start firing rockets into the combat base, Quezon combat base, and the first rocket that comes in lands in the ammo dump,
mm-hmm.
and it blows up 1,500 tons of ammunition, which was quite a show.
I can imagine.
And then there were probing attacks around the combat base, but they didn't actually attack in force. So it turned out that most of what this guy had told us was true.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's the story of how we got to the hill. And, of course, at that point, intelligence knew that there were three divisions of NVA
mm-hmm.
surrounding the Khe Sanh combat base,
mm-hmm.
and that we were effectively cut off in 81 South. So they flew a few helicopters in and got the battalion staff out, but they decided to leave my company up there. So the hill sort of was two knobs connected by a saddle.
Mm-hmm.
And so India Company took the bigger knob, and they sent my company down to the smaller knob, and that's where we stayed for the rest of the siege.
Hmm. Tell me about how you lived there on that hill.
Well, when we first got there, they had a trench line, and there was wire, of course, and they
mm-hmm.
had a trench line that was maybe 18 inches deep. And so most of the troops lived in sort of square sandbag bunkers that were fairly sizable. I mean, inside they might have been like 10 by 10,
mm-hmm.
and there'd be six or eight guys in there, and that's where they'd sleep, and they'd man the trenches during the day. And the reason given for the fact that the trenches weren't deeper was that this was just really hard clay, almost like rock.
Mm-hmm.
Digging was really difficult. I mean, you'd bend your E-tool trying to dig this stuff. Well, we started taking, 881 started taking incoming almost immediately before anybody realized there was a Tet offensive. We were getting these mortars and rockets that were landing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was just terrifying. I remember being just, I was just scared to death.
Was it 24 hours or was it a certain time they would do it?
It was 24 hours and it was sporadic. More during the day, really. I mean, we quickly figured out that any time that we were obviously under observation, and any time anybody moved on the hill,
mm-hmm.
They would shoot at them. We had snipers shooting at them and mortars.
Mm.
So, and I told you about earlier about the RPG that blew off Sobel's leg.
Yes.
And we had a number of other casualties, and it became obvious immediately that these sandbag bunkers were death traps. So the word went out, we are moving into the trenches. Well, under impetus of enemy incoming, the dirt got a lot softer.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before we had these trenches. In fact, they ended up digging them too deep some places. I mean, some of these places, the trench lines were down 8 feet.
Wow.
So I had to have them dig firing steps so they could step up and see out over the trench line so they could use them as defensive firing positions.
Mm-hmm.
And in relatively short order, I'd say within a week, we were living in the trenches. The troops would live in there, and then in the interior wall of the trench, they would scoop out a hole.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they would sleep. And, you know, that's what we did.
So you were protected unless a round fell in the trench itself.
That's right. And we quickly learned that moving around during daytime was an invitation to death or worse, death or injury. And so, I mean, during daytime, we just stayed in the trenches and you know, kept a lookout.
Mm-hmm.
And at nighttime, we'd have a more aggressive lookout, and we would put out listening posts, and at least initially, a few ambushes, but not very far out.
How far out would you put them?
Well, the hill was very steep. I mean, the north face was not quite straight down, but it was more than 45 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So we would just put an LP out, you know, 15, 20 yards in front of the wire.
Okay.
On the east nose, it was a little more gradual, and that was up where Dabney was, and he would put some ambush patrols out maybe 500 meters or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as the siege, as the Tet Offensive began and the siege went on, we got word directly from Westmoreland's headquarters that nobody was to go outside the wire under any circumstances.
Hmm.
I must admit that I was not willing to sit inside that wire blind all night, every night.
Essentially, that order came from Saigon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because when it came, you know, I disputed it in my Marine Corps chain of command, and they told me that, you know, they didn't decide it, that it was decided in Saigon.
Right.
It wasn't up to me. So I just ignored them, and I sent my listening post out every night anyway.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And, I mean, how was Westmoreland going to know?
True.
He certainly never visited. Nobody did.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how we lived. I actually moved into a bunker, not quite on the top center of the hill, but a little back from the trench line,
mm-hmm.
that had been dug by the NVA. I mean, it was in a existing bunker,
mm-hmm.
and we sort of enlarged a little bit, and we put an overhead on it. That overhead ended up being 6 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
We'd gotten ourselves a couple of pieces of airplane, planking, the kind of steel planking they used to make the airstrips,
mm-hmm.
and put them on top of them. So that was the first layer. Then we put sandbags, rocks, logs, everything we could think of, so that whole overhead was about 6 feet thick.
Right.
And we lived in there. I lived in there with my two radio operators.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually dug another part of the hole, sort of a second story to the damn thing, deeper back in there. That's where they slept. I never knew that I had any inkling of claustrophobia, but the first time I went back in that thing, I couldn't stand it, so I never went back there. Stayed up right by the front door.
How was communication on the hill?
Communications was very good. I talked before about the fact that we had RIC 25 radios all the way down to squad level.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when this first started, I remember just being so scared. I mean, it was almost like paralysis. And I just was convinced that Quezon was the focus of the free world, and that President Johnson and everybody between him and me was doing everything they could to get us out of there or to do something. Turns out I wasn't that far from correct.
Right.
We discovered later Johnson did have a mock-up of Quezon in the basement and was prowling around there at night,
mm-hmm.
Offering suggestions. But if you had told me on the first couple of days that we were going to be up there for 77 days,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I might very well just have shot myself. I mean, I don't think I could have taken that. It was hard enough to take hour by hour, day by day. But then, within a couple of weeks, you adjust. I mean, it's just amazing
how
resilient human beings are.
How do you adjust to that fear?
Well, for one thing, you sort of overcome the fear. I mean, it's hard to believe that sitting there getting mortared and rocketed, you can adjust to that. You can accept it,
mm-hmm.
but you do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I'll tell you now, one of the stories I've told most often, I got wounded twice up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time was probably, I think it was like mid-February. So, we've been up there, we've been under these conditions now for a little more than 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Trench lines have been dug down. The troops have actually found some extra comm wire and strung it around the trench so that the few radios can be hooked into extra speakers that we'd found from various places, taken out of downed helicopters and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we had music piped into the trenches, if you can believe that.
Wow. Hey, Tom, let me pause just for a second to change out the disc.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
So, we had very good and effective communications.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, as we were digging the trenches, actually, January 31st is when I became company commander, because Captain Galise decided to move from one side of the hill to the other instead of going around a trench line during the middle of the day.
Right.
Jumped up and ran across the top of the hill.
Oh, boy.
The sniper shot him in the leg. And so I got him medevaced. And actually, I was... that was a different medevac. I was wounded the first time during a medevac. But we got him out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a flesh wound. It went straight through the thigh, but didn't hit any bone or anything or an artery.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, he'll be back in 3 weeks. But that was January 31st. That was the beginning of the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, anybody who was stabilized, they put him back as far as they could to keep beds available closer to the front for more seriously wounded. The next time I heard from him, he was in the Philadelphia Naval Hospital.
Huh, wow.
And he never came back. So a day before I became a first lieutenant, I became the company commander of my company on Hill 881.
Huh.
And so right after that, the gunny decided he didn't want me running out of my bunker down the trench line. So they dug a connecting trench from
mm-hmm.
the bunker down to the trench, and we all moved underground.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to this adjustment, this resilience, we quickly settled into a pattern of staying underground and out of sight during the day,
mm-hmm.
and doing whatever we needed to do at night. But, you sort of got tired of that. You sort of started feeling like a rat, particularly since it was sort of monsoonal up there, and it was foggy and cold and rainy a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So one day in mid-February, it was a nice sunny day, one of the first we've had, and I'm sitting outside the bunker. My bunker was the entrance to it, the door for protruded about 2 feet, because of the dip in the terrain, protruded about 2 feet above the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to prevent any shrapnel from blowing through that door, we had put a sandbag wall about 2 feet away from it. And so I'm sitting on top of this sandbag wall, just sort of drying out and looking around and soaking up the sun. And by this time, most of what the enemy shot at us was 122-millimeter or 120-millimeter Russian mortars,
mm-hmm.
which were pretty devastating.
And could you hear them coming?
You could hear them come out of the tube. You could hear the thump.
Wow.
And we had figured out you had 26 seconds from the time you heard the thump until the round landed,
mm-hmm.
how high trajectory they were. So I'm sitting up there, and I hear this thump, and I'm saying to myself, you know, these guys are watching me. I'm not going to scurry into my hole like a rat. I'm just going to sit here.
Were you counting in your head?
Yeah. So about 15 seconds go by, and I say, you know, it'd be pretty dumb if you heard it come out of the tube, and because of false pride, it landed on you.
Mm-hmm.
So slowly, showing my disdain, slowly I got off the hill and sort of ambled into the through the door of the hooch.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I get through the door, the round lands. It lands right on the sandbag wall.
Wow.
And blew me through the, you know, the hooch and up against the far wall,
mm-hmm.
and filled the back of my legs and my butt with shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
Just small pieces. Of, I mean, it landed above me, and mainly what it did was blow dirt and pebbles and rocks, you know, down there. It really wasn't very much shrapnel. The shrapnel all went out and up.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, the blast blew me across the place and into the far wall and so forth. So I really wasn't very badly hurt. I was shook up a little bit, but I wasn't
mm-hmm.
badly hurt at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I often reflect on the potential devastating effect of false pride.
Right. What happened now with your wounds?
Pardon?
What happened with your wounds? Were you able to stay? Or
yeah.
Were you medevaced?
Yeah, but by that time we already recognized that the most dangerous thing that happened up there was the landing of a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we only medevac emergencies. So, you know, Doc patched me up a little bit, picked a few pebbles and stuff out of the wounds and
mm-hmm.
patched them up, but that was that.
Hmm. Okay.
Because we only had three places on the hill. One was in the saddle, and two were up on the sort of gradual nose to the east of India's position
mm-hmm.
where we could land a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, we'd already had three helicopters shot down. They were still there. Remember I said earlier we took the speakers and stuff out of them, and the 50-caliber machine guns, and they sort of decorated our landing areas. So it became obvious that the enemy had at least one mortar zeroed in on each of those three areas,
mm-hmm.
and as soon as they saw a helicopter approach, when they figured out which landing zone it was going to land in, they started pumping those rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have helicopters feint into one landing zone and then land in another, but still they only had 30, 40 seconds. And we'd have the medevac, we had a trench line out to the landing zone. We'd have the medevac in the trench with a couple of guys.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the helicopter didn't even land, as soon as it got close to the ground, they'd run out, throw the guy into the helicopter, jump back in the trench, and the helicopter would get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And this all had to be done within 30, 35 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there wasn't any coming and going from the hill, and there wasn't any medevacs except for emergencies.
What about resupplying?
Well, that became a problem.
Right.
So, originally what they did was they'd send a helicopter in every once in a while with an external load,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't getting enough up there. So what they finally did, somebody back in, I think it was Dong Ha, came up, or maybe Quang Tri came up with this concept, and of course we didn't have secure communications, so they didn't tell us about this. All we knew was one day we were told to stand by for something unusual, and a couple of A-4s, jets, came streaming up each side of the hill. Each side of the hill was sort of a little valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they were flying below the level of the hill, and they were trailing smoke. And right behind them were a bunch of Huey gunships, and they were just shooting up the whole valley and
mm-hmm.
the ridgeline on either side of us,
mm-hmm.
with rockets and stuff. And we look up straight above us, and there are about six CH-46 helicopters, each with an external load,
mm-hmm.
and they're flying a spiral down from above us, and when they get close to the hill, they drop their load, and they're out of there.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing takes 60 seconds, and we've got six loads of gear. Of course, the problem was we couldn't go out and get it during the day.
Right.
So we'd wait till night, and we'd go out and get it,
mm-hmm.
which brings me to my favorite story.
Okay.
One of the problems we had, initially we started out, we're a little short on food and water,
mm-hmm.
and then a little short on ammo, then a little short on food and water. But eventually, by the time they started doing these gaggles, so we called them soup gaggle and super gaggle,
mm-hmm.
Our supplies were fine. I mean, we had 2 C ration meals a day for each guy. Most of them would prefer to have more than that, but that's what they had. And I know my radio operator was Moose. He was a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
He ate a lot. It was really a hardship for him, and I've never eaten as much as my size would indicate, so I would give him half of my food. And it was interesting because one of the most valued commodities on the Hill became the cigarettes that were in the pack for the guys that smoked.
Mm-hmm.
But now most of them were out of their smokes, and there was a little pack of 4 cigarettes of him in each C ration. So the guys that didn't smoke could trade those cigarettes for canned peaches or other delicacies.
Mm-hmm.
I often said I think troops would have been glad to pay $50 for one of those tiny little cans of peaches because they weren't getting the money and didn't know whether they were going to spend it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, supply situation was getting better as a result of this, but one of the problems, or a morale problem I had, maybe my most serious morale problem, was mail.
Okay.
Mail would be brought in occasionally, but not very often. And the first 2 times mail had been brought in, it was all for India Company. So by now, it's been like 3 weeks since any of my troops have had any mail, and they are really unhappy. And the gunny says, "Sir, the troops are practically in revolt." He said, "I heard one of them say, next time mail comes in, if it's for India Company, not for Mike, they're going to attack Mike India Company and take their mail." So, I mean, it's getting to the point where I'm really concerned about
that. Right.
So I get the word one day that a gaggle's coming in, and I get my binoculars out, and these nets are wire mesh nets, so you can sort of see what's in them, and
mm-hmm.
mail arrives in bright red and yellow nylon bags. So I spot a bunch of bright red and yellow nylon bags in one of these loads. So I tell the gunnies, well, there's some mail coming in. So the gaggle lands about 1,400. Of course, we're not going to go out there and get it until
mm-hmm.
dark. Troops are really antsy. They really want to go. I don't want them to move right at dark because the enemy can figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
So about 2,200, I said, tell the gunny, okay, you can go out there and get the nets. They're
mm-hmm.
out in the saddle between the 2 hills. So they go out there, and I'm listening on the radio, and in a few minutes, I hear all kinds of cursing and carrying on out there. And I call the gunny and say, what the hell is going on? He says, you're not going to believe this, sir. Somebody decided to send us some ice cream. And it was in the same bagel, as the same net as the mail, and it's melted all over the mail.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So the troops are back there at night. They are really angry.
Oh,
it turned out it was mail from my company.
Oh.
If they could have found the poor mess sergeant who decided to do us a favor and send us some ice cream, they probably would have killed him.
Right.
You know, they're licking this stuff off their mail. I mean, it was hilarious.
So did that help the morale problem?
Yeah, it helped a lot.
Okay. Now, didn't these guys back at the base understand that you could not touch this stuff until night?
Apparently not. I mean, I guess probably the air wing did, but, you know, this probably came from, who knows, it might have been our executive officer. My executive officer
right.
was back at the base, you know.
Right. It's a good thought.
Yeah, it was a good thought. Exactly.
Yes. Let's take a break, sir.
Okay.
Okay, sir, I wanted to ask you about what happened on the night of the Tet Offensive. Did anything special happen there at your hill?
Nope.
Did you even know there was a so-called Tet Offensive that had started?
Not immediately.
Okay.
We were very isolated. Like I said, we didn't have secure communications, and
mm-hmm.
we weren't receiving, or at least only occasionally would we receive anything like a Stars and Stripes or anything. So
right.
We really didn't know what the hell was going on. I mean, over a period of time, it became obvious to us that there was the general activity. We certainly knew that Hue had been hit hard and that the Marines were in significant contact and in combat in Hue
mm-hmm.
that actually worried us because we were afraid that that would divert resources from rescuing us. So at that point, we figured, you know, the Marine Corps is going to get a couple divisions online and come down Route 9 and
mm-hmm.
kick those guys out of there. But
mm-hmm.
That didn't happen and couldn't have happened. I mean, the Marine Corps couldn't have amassed enough people to punch through, I don't think, in January and February through Route 9, not with that terrain anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we knew a little bit about it, but not really a whole lot. And as far as we were concerned, Tet Offensive had begun on January 20th.
Right, right. Did you know there was an actual siege of Khe Sanh going on?
Yeah, we figured it out. I mean, nobody told us that, but we figured out that they were everywhere. They were all around us. We knew that even between January 20th, I think, and January 31st, another battalion had been brought to Khe Sanh,
mm-hmm.
and they populated a couple of other outpost hills closer to the combat base.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew generally that was going on, yeah.
How difficult was it for you as a leader of the men there on the hill to not get those overall kind of broader scope intelligence reports? And I guess if you're not aware, then it might be ignorant bliss, but did you want a bigger picture? And if you did, how did it affect you to not get that?
Yeah, not only there, but throughout my tour. I mean, troops would periodically ask you why we did this or why we did that or what mm-hmm. was happening next or generally how what we were doing fit into the big picture.
Right.
And, I mean, I've often thought, I didn't know an awful lot, but I knew a hell of a lot more than they did. And I've often thought, tried to put myself in their position of just being there day to day and be told, do this and do that mm-hmm. and hurry up and wait and, take this bridge and then come back and take it 6 months later. And,
mm-hmm.
I think it must have been, mentally, it must have been an awful lot harder for them than it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sort of the same thing we talked about in training when you're just one of the guys running, you're tired as hell, but when you're the guy leading, you get a lot more on your mind, and
mm-hmm.
you can't think about your fatigue. I think it's the same kind of thing. That the mental aspects of the Vietnam experience were difficult enough at my level, I think, for the troops, it must have been even worse.
Right. Were you able to hide your apprehensions, your fears, your stress during the 77 days adequately from your men?
Yeah, I think so. I read somewhere by another guy about Vietnam saying that as long as you could, you were just a smidgen less scared than they were, it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I was.
Okay.
I certainly tried very hard at it because I recognized that that they took their lead from me. They were depending on me, and that if I showed those kinds of concerns, excessively at least, that it would be communicable
mm-hmm.
and would create a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think my primary response, we weren't engaging in much fire and maneuver. My primary duty, my primary responsibility, my primary task was to keep these guys alert and to help them maintain morale.
How often would you go out and visit them in their trenches?
Probably no more than 2 hours ever went by that I didn't.
Okay.
And sometimes more frequently than that. I mean, I would just sort of keep making the rounds.
Even during the day?
Yeah. Yeah, because I could do it in the trenches.
Right.
I could move around in the trenches during the day.
Right.
But of course, during the day, a lot of them were sleeping. You'd go around and talk to the ones who were awake, and then later on, you'd talk to the ones that you hadn't talked to before.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, see and be seen kind of thing.
Right, right.
And offer words of encouragement, and, just let them know somebody was paying attention, somebody cared.
How'd they respond to you?
They responded beautifully. I think back, a lot of these kids, I don't necessarily subscribe to the theory that it was the forgotten, the rejected, the poor, the uneducated who fought the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
but there certainly was an element in these 18, 19-year-old kids, some of whom, most of whom had graduated from high school, some of whom hadn't,
mm-hmm.
a couple of whom had been given the option of 3 years in the Corps or two in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly, we certainly were even then becoming aware of protesters, and the troops just couldn't understand that and were really demoralized by that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt tremendously privileged to, first of all, be given the responsibility to lead these guys, and secondly, and even more so, to be accepted by them as their leader.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very hard emotion to explain, and I rarely am able to even talk about it without getting a little choked up. But, I mean, I still thought, I mean, I thought then that I was doing the most important and significant thing that I was ever going to do. And I was just sort of in awe of being given the responsibility, basically life and death responsibility for these kids. And I felt an overwhelming responsibility for getting as many of them home as I could. You know, I thought often about people they'd left behind waiting for them. I had the unfortunate opportunity on more than one occasion to write a letter to next of kin about a trooper that didn't make it. And, you know, every time I did that, I'd had this tremendous welling of emotion that, you know, didn't overwhelm me, but it certainly made a dramatic impression on me. And the years have not diminished that. I mean, you know, I go to a reunion now, and these guys who were my kids, you know, are fat old bearded guys, are only a couple years younger than I am, but they're still my troops, and they still treat me that way. I mean, I'm still the old man. I'm still their guy. You know? It's much has been written and much has been spoken about this bond that is created by men in combat, and I've tried many times to put it in words. It's almost impossible to put into words. I've tried to explain it to people close to me, and I think they understand that there is a tremendous bond. But to them, I mean, like my wife could never understand why I didn't stay in touch with a lot of these people. When I don't really remember whether I told you about not knowing Moose's name. I think I did. And she says, you lived in the bunker with this guy for a hole in the ground for 77 days, and you don't know his name or where he's from? And, you know, and I really did not make much of an effort to stay in touch with any of these guys until I started going back to reunions.
Why not?
I don't know why. I don't know why. I mean, I'm not that kind of person. I mean, I'm the kind of guy, I've got a very good friend from college, is my roommate, but there may, you know, in the intervening years, there probably have been periods when we went 5 years without speaking to each other, but we were still good friends, and we still could pick it up anytime we want. In fact, he called me yesterday telling me his father died. I knew his father very well. But, I'm not that kind of a socializer, and I've been criticized by that, about that, by my wife and stuff, but that doesn't diminish the fact that there is a bond, a feeling of kinship, not only with the guys you actually served in combat with, but with any other guys that served in combat. You go to the reunion, and there are guys there that you didn't know, but there's an unspoken bond based on the commonality of experience. Certainly, with Vietnam veterans, I think some of it is the us against them feeling that, you know, the rest of the country didn't understand what we were doing. They don't understand or appreciate us now. They assume we're all a bunch of, you know, messed up drug heads and all that sort of thing. And we all know better. And each of us has proven something to ourselves and to each other that can only be proven in combat. That's the sort of an extreme human experience, and it calls upon you. You don't know when before you go how you're going to react. I was certainly apprehensive. What happens if I hit the first round? I hear I get down to the bottom of the hole and won't come out. And that happens to some guys. And you don't know which way you're going to react. The guys who talk the toughest before they go over there are probably at least as likely as everybody else to be found wanting. And when you find out that you actually can function under those circumstances, it's sort of a feeling of accomplishment and liberation that you know, admits you to this, the pantheon of those who have done it and experienced it. And it's an experience that you share with them that you haven't and won't ever share with, you know, your wife or your kids or your parents or all your other friends. And in my mind, you know, being a leader of Marines, 18, 19, 20-year-old Marines in Vietnam, as a company commander, which was, as I told you before, the sort of premier opportunity to do that, the best opportunity to do that, still awes me. I mean, I'm still delighted and proud of the fact that I had the opportunity, was given the opportunity, and was accepted by the troops as doing it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, just a minute ago, that you realized that that was the most important thing you would ever do in your life.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that while you were there? How did that dawn upon you?
Well, I mean, it's not that remarkable, really. You think about it, you say, hey, I'm out here in the jungle with 200 young Marines, and I'm in charge. And whether we accomplish our mission, and whether we get, how many we get killed or wounded, is a direct function of what I do and how well I do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got life and death responsibility for 200 human beings.
Mm-hmm.
When am I ever going to have that again?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been managing partner of a law firm for the last 27 years, and I think it's fair to say that I have a significant impact on the economics of all those people,
mm-hmm.
and therefore a significant impact in their life, but it doesn't even come close to being life and death.
Right. How often do you draw upon those experiences you had in Vietnam, or did you? How often did you draw upon those experiences after Vietnam, later in your life? We're skipping ahead, but I want to continue working there at the law firm and be in a position of leadership there. How much do you draw upon your experience?
I draw upon it, I mean, in some respects I could say every day, but not the way one might think, and not the way I expect it. I mean, everybody, I have sort of a very reserved demeanor, and I'm a pretty big guy.
Mm-hmm.
When people first meet me, they're almost invariably intimidated by me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was intentional when I was younger, and I've sort of never cleaned up that act. I mean, I don't do it intentionally now, but as a result of that, first impression, people always assume that I'm going to run the law firm like boot camp, or I'm going to be a martinet,
mm-hmm.
and that's not true at all. And one of the reasons it's not is I learned in Vietnam the importance of being able and willing to delegate responsibility, about being willing to take a chance on people. I mean, I would get my small unit commanders, I would get them trained, I'd be happy with them, and boom, two of them would get blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I got to replace them. And the guy who's in line to replace them, I don't have any confidence in. So based on his performance as just a trooper, I can't imagine this guy's going to be a successful leader.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, I was wrong. People rose to the occasion. If you showed confidence in them, you showed trust in them, you encouraged them, it's amazing. Sometimes these guys would be better than the guys they replaced. And so I've learned the importance of that. Probably the lesson that I apply on a daily basis more than any other is the importance of relying on the capabilities and the intuition of the person on the field. I mean, Vietnam was a war in which the decisions about what small units were going to do were almost invariably made by senior officers who were in a bunker somewhere long way from where the action was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, who had never been in a situation like we were in. I mean, most of the majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels in the Marine Corps had never been in combat,
mm-hmm.
Certainly not in small unit combat. And I mean, the most common example is, you know, some guy back in a bunker gets out his map and says, okay, I'm going to tell Esslinger to move India Company from here to here, and it's, you know, 4,000 meters, and you know, I'll tell him get moving in the morning so he can be there by evening. Well, on a map, you can do it, but in the jungle up around Khe Sanh, especially if you were going to move through an area that was potentially hostile and you had to do it in a tactical situation,
mm-hmm.
you were lucky if you could make 1,000 meters a day in that kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being pressured and ordered by colonels and majors back in the rear over the radio who couldn't understand why you weren't making more progress was frustrating in the extreme. In fact, one of the stories I wrote down here to remind you about, but I'll tell you now, is
mm-hmm.
You've heard me talk about Major Caulfield.
Yes.
He was Captain Caulfield, my first company commander. I had a very close relationship with him. For some reason, he took a shine to me right away, and I liked him. We were very different. He was a voluble Irishman full of the blarney from New York.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved to hear him talk. Later on in the tour, he would, when we were in a static position, he would bring in new troops and give them an orientation speech.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I'd heard him give it dozens of times, I would always make a point of being there because I just loved to hear him talk, and it always inspired me all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I remain close even today. But shortly after, it was before Christmas at KSON.
Mm-hmm.
I was out on patrol. I'd been out for a couple of days. I was still a couple of thousand meters. I was on my way back to the combat base, but a couple thousand meters away. And I figured I'd get back the next day, which was Christmas. But about midday on Christmas Eve, he called me on the radio and told me he wanted me back by dark.
Mm-hmm.
That I can't do it. He says, do it. And so he and I had a debate over the radio. And I remember saying, I finally said, look, you know that what you're telling me to do is wrong. I said, I'm going to do what you tell me to because you're a major and I'm a lieutenant. I said, but, you know, if any of these troops get hurt because of this, you know, it's going to be on your head. And so I seized the whole way back. We basically walked down a trail, exposing ourselves to ambush so we could get back because it was the only way we could get back by dark. And you know, nothing happened. And when I got there, I'd been thinking about it for 8 hours, and I was primed. I went over to the COC and asked him to step outside, and he did. And I just exploded all over. I said, you taught me not to do that. You taught me that in a position like that, not to obey an order that's going to endanger my troops.
Mm-hmm.
And then you forced me to do it. I said, you know, of you of all people. And he didn't say anything. I mean, he just sort of said, you know, the general ordered me to have everybody back here because the Christmas truce starts at dark.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it's interesting because when I was 50, my wife, for my 50th birthday, asked a lot of people to write letters, and he was one of them, and he remarked on that incident in the letter.
Really?
And said that he was wrong, he knew he was wrong, and he said that he ended up going on to retire as a general officer, and he was in charge of the basic school for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he used that as an object lesson in training lieutenants ever since.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that was, I don't remember why I got off on that tangent, but anyway, there it is.
You said you were wounded twice. What happened the second time?
I was supervising a medevac, and, you know, as the helicopter took off, 120-millimeter mortar came in and caught a few pieces of shrapnel on my lower leg.
Mm-hmm. But you
I still have effects of that in my left ankle, which is arthritic as a result of it.
Hmm.
But it certainly wasn't serious enough to justify bringing in a helicopter. I think probably that's what I think there was ended up being a piece of shrapnel that was in the ankle joint there that was there too long and did some bone damage, and that's probably why I've got the arthritis.
I can imagine your men seeing their commander being wounded twice, and them understanding about the medevac rules, I guess. You know, let's just die or you're not going to get out. But you staying online with them, having been wounded. Do you think that made an impression upon them?
I think it did, but I don't think it probably was as dramatic as you imagine it might be, because by the time we were done, most of them had done the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's something like I went up there with 120 men,
mm-hmm.
and you know there were a few replacements, but not many. And I think those 120 men accumulated something like 175 purple hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Up there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a lot of minor wounds like that. It was almost impossible not to get them, but we only medevaced the serious ones.
What else happened during the 77 days that you want to talk about?
I got a couple of little odds and ends here.
Okay.
Going back to, I should have thought about this when you were talking about the how we lived up there.
Mm-hmm.
When I got down onto the small knoll that my company took care of for those 77 days, in addition to the trenches not being very deep, the latrine was above ground. It was sort of a box with half of a 55-gallon drum in it. You sat on over top of that. And they had put up a couple of sticks on the back and stretched a poncho across it because it was windy up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting up there, this is early on, and I'm sitting there doing my business, and I'm thinking, well, there aren't too many people have a view like this while they're doing their business.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got done, and I leaned down and was ready to pull up my pants, and a bullet snapped through that poncho right where I've been sitting. Sniper had zeroed in on me. So I sort of hobbled down to my into the trench, trousers around my ankles, you know.
Uh-huh.
Called the gunny over and said, that latrine will be in the trenches by nightfall.
Wow. So you, when you leaned over, the bullet hit where you had...
I bent forward to pick up my trousers, and it went right behind my head, you know, into the poncho liner.
My gosh.
Another sort of moderately humorous, although it wasn't then, story. Again, right after I took over that part of the hill,
mm-hmm.
we had our own 60-millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to register, have a couple registration points just outside the wire. So I called the mightiest corporal in the world that I talked about before,
mm-hmm.
Corporal Arata, who was
yes.
running air attacks in all over the place. And it was getting on toward dusk. And I said, let me know when you're done. And he said, he called me back after a while, and he said, okay, I think we're done. So I had my 60-millimeter mortar people ready to fire a couple of white phosphorus rounds and get them registered on certain points.
Mm-hmm.
And so they fire the first one, and the white phosphorus explodes about 10 meters outside our wire, which is where I want it. And at the corner of my eye, I look up, and I see two F-4s rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, what's that? And I look down in the valley and see a big white phosphorus down there that is one of the last spotting rounds fired by the corporal. And that was the round that the F-4s were supposed to roll in on, but they saw mine.
Uh-oh.
And so these two F-4s are rolling in on our hill.
Right.
And, you know, what can I do? I mean, everybody sees them. They can hear them coming. We all dive into the trenches. And I thought, oh, my God. So they dropped a couple of 250-pound bombs, but fortunately they dropped them right on the white phosphorus. And it blew our wire all the hell and shook us all up, but nobody
mm-hmm.
got hurt.
Mm.
But I was had a few very bad moments there.
What did you say when you called back to the base? Did you tell them, report what had it happened?
Yeah. You know, one of those things that happens when guys are out there with guns and explosives, they sometimes put it in the wrong places.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was too excited about it. They were delighted nobody was hurt.
Right.
Let's see, anything else up there? No, I don't think so.
Well, how did the 77 days come to an end for you all up there?
Well, for me, right at the end of March, as a medevac helicopter came in, some guy jumps off and runs out and jumps in the trenches, and it turns out it's Captain Harry Jenkins,
mm-hmm.
and he's there to relieve me as company commander of my company. So the next medevac we had, I was one of the guys that carried the guy out there, and then after we threw him into the chopper, I jumped in after,
mm-hmm.
and I went down to the combat base to become Caulfield's assistant in the operations office, the S3 Alpha.
Okay.
We had a new battalion commander named John Stute. He was a very good officer and a very proactive guy. He was concerned. He became concerned about these sort of hodgepodge bunkers everybody had built everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That they weren't properly engineered and that they were going to collapse on people. So he ended up sort of giving me an additional duty of becoming the battalion bunker officer, so I would run around, inspect bunkers, and make suggestions for
mm-hmm.
the force and stuff. And then, basically, on April 1st,
mm-hmm.
the name of the operations changed from Scotland to Scotland 2.
Mm-hmm.
The 1st Air Cavalry Division of the Army was assigned to help us. And they started trying to force their way up Route 9.
Right.
And eventually they did, and they met with some Marines coming out from the combat base.
Mm-hmm.
And so the denouement of the whole thing was that on Easter Sunday of 1968, which I think was April 15th,
mm-hmm.
We were going to attack off of 881 South and take 881 North because the NVA had been up there. They had used that as a primary position to fire 122-millimeter rockets at the base.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't know if I mentioned, that was one other thing we did up on the hill. This is Dabney's idea. The major incoming that the base received came from three different positions, all out to the west.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of those rounds passed over our hill on the way to the combat base,
mm-hmm.
and we could hear them. And actually, there was an old radar dish, a big one, maybe about 10 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
It was up there, I guess, from a radio relay station or something. So Dabney positioned this thing facing west, and all day, every day, there would be a trooper sitting inside that dish, so that thing helped him to pick up sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a radio connected directly to the combat base, and as soon as he heard anything, he would call the combat base, and they had somebody monitoring that call,
mm-hmm.
and he would report, you know, Artie Korok or Rocket 365, which was a compass heading. And this guy at the base had a little button there that blew a truck horn.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as he got that call, he'd press the truck horn, and the horn would blow at the combat base, which gave them anywhere from 5 to 10 seconds advance notice of incoming, and they could, you know, dive into trenches.
Right, right. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Huh.
So, and as an example of, you know, Dabney was always thinking. He was a very innovative, very iconoclastic guy. I mean, it's almost as though he read the Marine Corps book and said, there's got to be a better way, and did everything differently.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up moving the whole battalion up to 881 in the second week of April.
Mm-hmm.
And that Sunday morning, we took off. I think India Company stayed on the hill, and the other three companies did what India Company had tried to do on January 20th, which was attack north,
mm-hmm.
off the hill toward 881 north. We moved over objectives 1 and 2, where Mike Thomas and Tom Brindley had been killed on the 20th, and started climbing up 881 north. We ran into a fair amount of resistance, but we were loaded for bear. We had air on station. We had all kinds of pre-registered artillery. Dabney had taken all the 106s the battalion had and mounted them on the north side of 881 south, and so he could fire directly over our heads,
mm-hmm.
Direct fire with 106s, so if we ran into like a machine gun or something, we would just pop a smoke pull back and Dabney would blow it away with 106s. He was having a great time doing that. And we climbed the hill at about 1400 in the afternoon, put an American flag up on top of 881 north.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we took, you know, a number of casualties, but it wasn't that bad. The enemy had sort of resisted us, but not all out. They sort of pulled back as we came up, and there weren't all that many casualties, but it was a pretty pretty emotional moment for us.
How did that feel to put that flag up there?
It felt pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were sort of under orders not to fly the American flag anywhere, but we ignored that. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, this is also well known.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing Dabney did on the hill was he started raising the American flag every morning. We had at least one guy, Owen Matthews, who ended up taking Mike Thomas's place as the platoon commander of 2nd Platoon,
mm-hmm.
Could play the bugle, and for some reason there was a bugle up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so every morning they'd dash out of the trench, he'd play a very accelerated version of To the Colors, and he'd run this damn flag up and try to dive back in the trenches as the mortar rounds came in, and every evening they'd do the same thing. And this got to be fairly well known. It got to be reported. And so pretty soon, every time we got mail, we would get U.S. American flags from everywhere. So, and Dabney would take one each day after it was flown, and he'd mail it to one of the KIA or severely wounded
wow.
guy's parents.
Wow.
It's funny that, you know, we never had a visit during the siege, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody came there casually. But, you know, none of the senior officers from regiment or battalion or division or anybody else ever landed on the hill. Dabney is very bitter about that. And in fact, I'm going to tell you about a website. And he's got a ranting on there about that, in which he vents his spleen at some length.
Mm-hmm.
But one day, we did have, during a medevac, as the chopper came in, a guy jumped off and he came into the trench.
Mm-hmm.
And the troops brought him to me, and turns out this guy is a stringer for UPI.
Mm-hmm.
He's a reporter, and he's got his camera along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Dave Powell.
Okay.
And so he stays on the hill. My recollection was he wasn't there very long, but his is that he was there at least one night, maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
And he went around and took a bunch of pictures and talked to the troops. And then he decided he was ready to leave. And so he comes over to me and says, okay, I'm ready to leave. Would you call me a helicopter? I said, well, that's not the way it works. It's too dangerous to just call a helicopter so you can come in the way you came out, go out the way you came in on a medevac helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't too pleased about that, and so he starts telling me all the people, important people he knows, and threatening me. And after a while, I said, look, nothing you say is going to change my mind. So this is the way it's going to happen. You're going to be ready. If we have an emergency medevac, you're going to be one of the guys that carries him down to the LZ. And if you throw him into the chopper, you're going to jump in after him.
Mm-hmm.
He was not pleased about that, but that's the way it went down. And actually, subsequently, my mother sent me an article that he wrote that mm-hmm. appeared in one of the papers. He very nicely promoted me to captain, and she knew my name. And that was the last I ever heard of him. Until about a year, year and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
I started getting emails from an address I didn't recognize. And this guy was telling me that he had pictures of us on 881, and I couldn't figure out who this was. And finally, over a period of time, I figured out who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he volunteered to send me some of these pictures, but he used AOL, and he never could figure out how to attach them, so I never got them.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequently, Dabney, who's now retired and living in Lexington, Virginia, was prowling the Internet, and he discovered the Internet site of the Purple Foxes, which was the helicopter squadron that was responsible for most of our medevacs and resupply.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up calling this guy, Frank Gulledge, who was a retired officer from a helicopter pilot who ran that site, and, thanking him and telling him about some of the things the helicopters did and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
One thing led to another, and Dabney lamented the fact that there wasn't a website like that for 881.
Mm-hmm.
And Gulledge said, well, why don't you guys put a sub-website on my site?
Mm-hmm.
And so they did. And not long after that, Powell found it, and he successfully uploaded all of his pictures of 881,
mm-hmm.
about 80 of them. Of course, these are very good pictures.
And mm-hmm.
he was a good photographer. And so I had never had any pictures of the hill, and now all of a sudden here are these 80 pictures of the hill and a lot of the troops,
mm-hmm.
several of me, some of me and Dabney together, some of the flag raising. It's really been a tremendous boon for all of us and caused a lot of communication among us
mm-hmm.
and with him. And in fact, one of my troops had the bright idea of inviting Powell to our reunion in Charleston this year.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what he did was he called me and said, I know Powell's not well off. Would you be willing to pay for his airfare to bring him out? And I said, sure. And we made the offer. It turns out that he apparently is just in the recovery or withdrawal stages from alcoholism, and his family felt that that environment was not a good one to put him in right
mm-hmm.
now.
Yes.
So he declined our offer, but said he's really anxious to come, and that he'll probably come next year. So
great.
And all
get
back together with him. I've seen a couple of messages he's put on the site. He is just thrilled to death that the Marines have embraced him the way they have,
right.
and sort of accepted him as one of them.
What's that website address?
The website
where the pictures are.
www.hmm, it's medium helicopter or whatever, -364, hmm-364.org.
Okay.
If you go there, there's a big table of contents, and there's a couple of them that involve Dave Powell. One is just his photos, and another one is some stuff he's written.
Okay. While we're on the subject, what did you...
Excuse me.
Sorry.
When you go to the main website, the Purple Foxes website,
yes.
There's a sub-site called the Warriors of 881 South.
Okay.
So you got to click on that, and then you can find
the
list of Powell and Dabney's comments and all that stuff.
Okay. All right. What did you think of the media coverage of the war overall, then and now?
Well, I thought that the media coverage was, I want to say biased, but, I recognize, I've read enough now that I know that the sense that the media had, that they were being lied to, there was a lot of validity to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they reacted to that, and it sort of became a contest between them and the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they disliked and disrespected the senior officers that they were being briefed by and so forth. And so that ended up coloring their reporting, made them more inclined to try to show up the military, I think,
mm-hmm.
or to undermine or to question what was being put out by the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that was destructive of morale, and probably in some cases, and it led, along with the protests and actions of people like Jane Fonda, to, I mean, there's no question that it emboldened the North and gave them an incentive to persevere and a way to win the war without winning it militarily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, General Jopp and lots of others have said that in their writings.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my mother saved a lot of the stuff,
mm-hmm.
and when I came back, I read through all the stuff she had saved, and I said, my God, if I'd known it was so bad, I don't think I could have stood it. I mean, it, like movies, it portrays... I mean, a military movie doesn't portray the real deal because it doesn't have the long, quiet periods of boredom and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one cataclysmic event after another, and if it really did happen that way, I don't think anybody could stand it. But I think they over-dramatized it, and it didn't portray a very real picture in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when were you transferred away from Khe Sanh?
Well, the morning after the Easter attack, mm-hmm. we were helicoptered back down to the combat base.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that they were gonna send in six-wing bigger planes and fly us back to Quang Tri, but the enemy decided to keep throwing stuff in on the airstrip, so they didn't want to risk bringing the big planes in. So they staged us all around the combat base in small groups and did a helicopter shuttle, which took all day.
Mm-hmm.
While we were down there at the combat base waiting for them, we got some incoming, and one of my platoon commanders, Skip Ammon, got killed.
Mm.
We finally all got back to Quang Tri. This probably was April 17th or 18th. And the 3rd Marine Division band was waiting for us. We sort of got off the helicopters, immediately took off all of our utilities. You got to remember now, these are all guys who haven't eaten a hot meal, haven't had a shower, haven't shaved, and haven't changed clothes in calendar year 1968. It's now
mm-hmm.
April. So we took off these unbelievably grungy utilities, threw them in the fire, went through a shower, came out the other end and got clean utilities, went and sat down and had a steak dinner. And got mail, and one of my radio operators who had been wounded and left the hill and never came back and was mm-hmm. back in the States had sent me 2 bottles of Tijauvais Beaujolais,
uh-huh.
which I had with the wine.
Mm-hmm.
They were in a separate little mail bag. There was a note from the postmaster in San Francisco that said that 3 bottles had been sent, but 1 had broken, and he had forwarded the other 2 and wished me luck, which was nice since
mm-hmm.
shipping alcohol through the mails was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But he sent it anyway, and we had a great time with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all bedded down in those kind of hardback tents I talked to you about before,
mm-hmm.
all took a deep sigh, said, whew, we made it. And about that time, about 2000, for the first time in a month, the NVA rocketed Quang Tri with 122-millimeter rockets. They all landed in our battalion area, and
three more
guys got killed.
Oh.
And morale went from sky high to as low as it has ever been in the space of about 2 minutes. I mean, there was a feeling like, you know, it's getting personal. These guys want us. They're going to follow us around. You know?
Right.
So that's how we got out of there.
What did you do after that attack? How did you get the men together and get them back up again?
Well, you know, we had a lot of time to sit around and speculate while we were at Khe Sanh, and we were convinced that at the very least they would send us back to Okinawa and, you know, refit us,
mm-hmm.
take care of our dental problems and our health problems and our pay problems and our, you know, domestic problems and all that kind of stuff, and
mm-hmm.
then we'd come back as the special landing force, which was there was always a battalion on ships offshore, and we thought we'd come back that way. But it never didn't happen. We just came back, and you know they started giving us new assignments, and we did them, and we bitched and moaned and fussed and carried on about it. But
mm-hmm.
you know, we weren't even in very good physical shape at that point, so it took us a while to work ourselves back into good physical shape since we'd been sitting around on that hill for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we just went on. I mentioned Skip Ammon's name a while ago, and that reminds me
yes.
of something from the hill that I forgot.
Okay.
We had talked about resupply, and unbeknownst to me, Skip, who was the 2nd Platoon commander, had apparently in the early days of February, when our resupply was at its worst, had written a letter to his mother that pointed that out. And his mother, being a caring mother, decided to do something about it, so she contacted her congressman and wanted to know why the Marine Corps was not feeding her baby properly.
Mm-hmm.
And that resulted in a congressional inquiry letter, which I received on the Hill from her congressman wanting to know why I wasn't feeding her son. And I was really pissed.
Mm-hmm.
I was very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote sat down and wrote a very long and very impassioned letter. I've read it since, and I'm sort of embarrassed by my vehemence and my passion,
mm-hmm.
To Congressman John Rhodes, who was a senior Republican in the House of Representatives. I don't think he was yet the minority leader, but he shortly after that became the minority leader of Republicans in the House. He was the father of my college roommate, Jay Rhodes, and he had been on my list of he got all my letters from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this one directly to him, you know, saying, hey, you know, this is a tough situation here. The Marine Corps is doing the best it can, and nobody's trying harder than the Marine Corps to take care of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he ended up publishing that letter in the Federal Register or the Congressional
mm-hmm.
Record, I guess it is.
Yes.
I got copies of that. I mentioned earlier that one of my college friends called me yesterday and said his father died. That was Congressman Rhodes.
Mm.
He was an outstanding American and a great human being and a big influence on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote, you know, I said I wrote to him. He wasn't my congressman. He's from Arizona. But I said I thought his would be a good ear to bend.
Mm-hmm.
So that letter's still there in the Congressional Record.
Yes, sir. So tell me about at Coingtree. Did you run operations out of Coingtree, or were you sent elsewhere?
Yeah, we ran out of Coingtree for a while. I remember we had security for an important bridge on Route 1 just outside of Coingtree for a while. We sort of just camped around there, you know, washed and swam in the river.
Mm-hmm.
We had Navy frogmen attached because they were worried about them trying to blow the bridge up in the water. And we ran some operations out of there, but that was sort of our base for 3 or 4 weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be late April, early May.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a bunch of those kinds of things. And then sometime, well, let me go back.
Mm-hmm.
When I left Quezon, I was Caulfield's assistant to S3 Alpha. And I think I told you last time about the Dabney had left India Company and been replaced by this senior captain, and I told you that he came back and said that he wasn't cut out for that duty.
Yes, sir.
And so in late April is when I took over India Company. We went out in this operation. And then mid-May, I believe it was, early May,
mm-hmm.
We got orders that the whole battalion, that we were being transferred to the 1st Marine Division. We had been attached. Technically, the 3rd Battalion, 26th Marines, is part of the 5th Marine Division, which had been activated during World War II,
mm-hmm.
were the people that raised the flag at Iwo Jima.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, the 5th Marine Division was deactivated. And it wasn't activated again. As a division, it was never really activated. They created its battalions, 1, 2, and 3 Battalion, 26th Marines, and the 27th Marines, for Vietnam, but they never activated the division itself. So we were always attached to either the 1st or the 3rd Division, which was the 2nd Marine Division headquarters in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The 3rd Division had the northernmost area along the DMZ, and that's who we had been attached with up until now. And now we were being transferred to the control of the 1st Marine Division, which was south of the 3rd Marine Division in the area around Da Nang and to the south of Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a different kind of war.
Mm-hmm.
It was more a rice paddy war, although for us we ended up out in the mountains most of the time. More booby traps, more contact with indigenous personnel. So we get this word that we're going to 1st Marine Division, and so we get flown to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
We get to Da Nang. We have to wait for trucks. The trucks finally get there. They truck us out to, a regimental headquarters, the headquarters of one of the regiments. We get there in the middle of the afternoon. You know, we're tired. We've been feeling sort of pushed around. Hurry up and wait, and nobody seemed to know what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we get there, and about 1700, we get word that my company, India Company, is going to be loaded on trucks, and we're going out to this place called Godoy Island.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a guy there to meet us and tell us what's going on. So we truck out there. It's about 18:30 now, just starting to get dark. And there's a major there from division headquarters, and he tells me that my mission is that we're on a road. Right next to the road is this little bridge. It goes across this canal-like thing and goes out onto what's called Godoy Island,
mm-hmm.
which had been used repeatedly by the NVA to rocket. It was within range of the airstrip at Da Nang, and they were rocketing the airstrip from Da Nang. So it was decided we were going to do something about it. So I said, okay, this major tells me I'm supposed to go across the bridge, go out onto Godoy Island. He said there's some popular forces out there which were like local South Vietnam militia. They had regional forces and popular forces.
Mm-hmm.
The popular forces really were just a bunch of old men and kids with rifles,
mm-hmm.
and they were not very well trained, and Marines were scared to death of them,
mm-hmm.
because they would just shoot at anything that moved, and if you were in their area and they were in your area, it was a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, has anybody contacted the PS and let them know we're coming? They said, no, you'll have to do that. I said, let me get this straight. It's getting dark. You want me to take my Marines out onto this piece of land that I've never seen before? You want me to contact the PS who don't know we're coming, and then you want me to put in ambushes for tonight? The major said, that's it. I said, not going to do it. He said, what do you mean? I said, it's a recipe for disaster. I mean, there's no way that it can be done and done well without disastrous results, so I'm not going to do it. I'll go out there first thing in the morning and secure that island for you, but we're staying right here tonight. Well, he got apoplectic. He says, you can't do that, Lieutenant. I'm a major. And I said, whose idea was this? He said, this was General Robertson's, the division commander.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, I'll tell you what. You go back and you tell General Robertson, if he really wants me to do this, he should call me and tell me himself personally, and if he does, I'll do it. Otherwise, I ain't going. So he got all pissed off and says, well, you'll hear about this, and got in his Jeep and roared off.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't go out. And I did not hear anything more about it until about 2 months later. I was in the company, was standing by General Robertson to come up with this new idea, which actually was a pretty good idea, I thought, of having a company in full combat gear sitting on the helicopter landing pad at all times,
mm-hmm.
so that reconnaissance units and others that were out in the field, if they spotted something or made a contact, we could jump in helicopters and be there immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting there waiting for this, and the call came in that they'd spotted some NVA moving along the ridge or some people. And we jumped in the helicopters. We went out there. We secured the area. We captured a couple of them. We brought them back. And I think that was the first time that this particular tactic had yielded something.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I get off the helicopter, there's a guy waiting for me. He says, the general wants to see you. I jump in. I go back, and General Robertson wants to debrief me.
Mm-hmm.
Still got my flak jacket on. I walk in, and I report to him. And he says, ah, Esslinger, I remember you. He says, you know, it's a damn good thing you were right. And that's the last I ever heard of it.
Huh. So he agreed with you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, didn't take a genius to figure out that was
right.
A stupid thing to do.
Right.
And it sort of is not what you would expect from a Marine general, but he obviously
mm-hmm.
was not an idiot.
Mm-hmm. So what other comments?
And remembered having been a lieutenant once himself, no doubt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What are the kind of operations did you run from out of that area?
Well, right after that, I sort of thought that the 1st Division probably didn't know what to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with this new mission. Da Nang was on the coast. There was a big air base there. Then there was a couple of miles of flat rice paddy area. And then you started fairly quickly and fairly dramatically rising into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And the NVA owned those mountains, and they would attack Da Nang Air Base from there.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to do something about that. So I got the orders. I think I was at Hill 55, which was a regimental headquarters. It was in the lowlands. And I got orders to march out into those mountains. And so we mounted up. We were going to be out there for weeks and, you know, carried as much gear as we could and started out. You know, I guess it's May or June, and it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start marching, climbing up over these low hills that are covered with thick elephant grass, which is about 6 feet high. And so it's probably 105 degrees outside,
mm-hmm.
and we're moving through this thick grass. We have to, it will cut you, so you have to, you know, roll your sleeves down and cover everything up, because if it just touches your skin, it just slices it like a knife.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no air moving in there, and it is very humid and very hot. And we start having heat problems. So we stop, and we medevac some guy, because the corpsman says he's in bad shape. And then we move another 1,000 meters, and it happens again. And so we're making very little progress, and now we're starting to climb more steep inclines.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 2 days of this, I got the officers and the senior non-combat together, and I said, okay, this cannot go on because we're not making any progress, and every time we stop and medevac, tell the enemy where we are.
Right.
So I said, here's the deal. I said, from now on, there will be no more medevacs for heat casualties. I said, if somebody feels bad, we will stop. We'll give them 15 minutes. The corpsman will treat them. And then we'll move on. And if he's up to moving on with us, fine. If he's not, two of his buddies will stay there with him until he's ready to catch up with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody wanted to be left behind, and nobody wanted to stay with a heat casualty.
Right.
So we didn't have any more heat casualties, which I thought was great.
Mm-hmm.
As an aside, when I got back, I told my buddy Rich Foley about it, and he tried it with his unit. And the first time he tried it, he had a guy die of heat exhaustion.
Oh, wow.
I guess. So I guess I was just lucky. Anyway, we started moving up into these mountains, cutting our way. And this is back when we were talking about using dogs and stuff. So this
mm-hmm.
is when we started doing it, because you know, we were having trouble. We were getting in this thick triple canopy with a lot of undergrowth vines. And in order to make progress, we either had to move on trails and risk ambush, or we had to move at a snail's pace by literally whacking our way through it with
mm-hmm.
machetes, in which case people could hear us coming anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally made it up to the first big hilltop. And we got there, and there was this, you know, triple stand of jungle and trees, these huge teak trees and other kinds of big trees that were probably 150 feet high. And they sent a helicopter out, and it lowered on cables through the top some chainsaws, and we became a logging operation and cut down all these trees and cleared a space on the top of the hill big enough for helicopters to land. And they came in with engineers who started blowing a bigger landing zone, and then the battalion headquarters came in, and they brought in artillery, and we had a new fire base.
Hmm.
Meantime, we pushed off to the west and did it again,
mm-hmm.
climbed to a higher one. And we did this probably 8-9 times. And India Company was almost always in the lead, troops bitching and moaning.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point, the colonel decided to give us a break and sent Mike Company, I think it was, out. And then the troop says, well, what's going on? What did we do wrong? Why is the colonel with us? You know.
Uh-huh.
So we did that, and we did it fairly well and was pretty effective. And that was the operation on which we finally got over the top of the highest mountain and down the other side on a reverse slope, found that regimental artillery headquarters I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I told you about another event there that was memorable. After we'd done this 4 or 5 times, we had cleared this one landing zone, and we'd gotten this down to pretty efficient operation. As soon as they were able to start landing helicopters, they would. The engineers would expand the landing zone. Then more helicopters would come in. They'd bring in the artillery, bring in a lot of ammunition. And so on this particular hill, we had done the usual thing, you know, and as we cut the small clearing, my troops had manned positions around the landing zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the landing zone expanded and more troops came in, I'd come over and move my troops further down the hill away from the landing zone because
mm-hmm.
they needed more room for everything was coming in. And so it's, again, about dusk. And one of the last helicopters is coming in, and it's carrying a load of troops. And by now, the landing zone is chock full of cases of food and ammo about chest high.
Mm-hmm.
And so the helicopter is actually going to land on top of all this stuff and discharge these troops. And they sort of would dip down below the level of the hill and then climb into the hill sort of to give them a little more purchase. And as he was doing this, this helicopter pilot sort of lost his way a little bit, and he started sliding to port.
Mm-hmm.
And as he did so, one of the blades came in contact with one of the big trees,
mm-hmm.
which caused it to fly off and go whizzing across the landing zone, where it hit a Marine midsection and cut him in half.
Mm.
And then the helicopter crashed on top of, you know, came crashing down on top of all this stuff and immediately started smoking. And it just so happened that, you know, I'd come back up from my company because the battalion commander was there, and he called a meeting of the company commanders, and so we were all there meeting just off the landing zone. We heard this crash. We came running to the landing zone, and there's this helicopter. And a couple guys are screaming out of it. The helicopter's smoking. It's sitting right on top of cases and cases of 81mm and 105 artillery ammo. And this is a bad situation. So one of the majors stopped one of the troops coming off a helicopter and says, "Is everybody off?" He said, "No, I think there are a couple guys that are trapped on there, knocked out or something." Major says, "We got to go get these guys." I'm thinking, who's we? I don't want to go into that helicopter. But the major and I jump up and we get into the helicopter, and by now there's a small fire in the tail. And, you know, these things are, I don't know what the metal was, but once they caught fire, it went fast. And, of course, we knew there was plenty of fuel on board this thing, and we knew we were sitting on top of high explosives, but there were a couple guys who were strapped into seats, and they were either groggy or knocked out. And so we got our knives, cut them loose, got them to the door, threw them out, went back and got the other ones, and then a couple of other guys grabbed them, and then we jumped off that thing and, you know, dove off the landing zone, and just as we did, the damn helicopter blew up. And it started cooking off these rounds. So the whole landing zone basically caught fire. And, you know, all night these rounds would cook off. The guys back at the Da Nang said they could see it. It was like fireworks when these white phosphorus rounds would catch fire and go arcing over the mountain.
Wow.
And so I got back finally after, you know, my adrenaline high drained itself and I got control of myself. A couple hours later, I got back down to my company. And one of the troops took me aside and says, "Sir," he says, "that helicopter crashed right where my hole was last night." He says, "Moving us down here was the smartest thing you ever did, sir." Because, you know, they were perfectly protected down there.
Right, right.
Away from all the madness.
Wow.
So that was what we were doing. We spent, I'd say, the better part of May and June doing those kinds of operations.
Did you have any enemy contact?
We had the occasional, you know. The dog would sniff out ambushes. And we would either outflank them or call in our supporting arms if it was a position where we could do that. We had the contact at the, when we found that regimental artillery headquarters. Again, I think it was mostly just a rear guard while the rest of them left, because we had obviously surprised them. When we got there, there was still food cooking and stuff like that.
Was this when you were working with the Chuhoy?
Yeah, working with the Chuhoy and with dogs.
Okay. Tell me about the Chuhoy experience. How well could you trust this guy?
Well, you know, initially you have a lot of reservations. But I don't remember. You know, I never did really learn exactly what they were. But I did learn later that there were incentives and disincentives that these guys had been given. And what I would do is, you know, I always made him go first. I mean, if we ask him, you know, one of the things these guys were good at was spotting the signs. The NVA would leave signs about the marking booby traps and sometimes even ambushes. And, of course, he knew how to recognize them when we didn't.
Right.
So he'd tell me what he thought was happening. I'd say, "Fine, go out there and see if you're right." You know? But over a period of time, they would change periodically, but I had one that I had for a while that I actually became pretty good friends with, you know. He liked the fact that I could speak a little Vietnamese to him, and, and we got along pretty well. I actually became fairly friendly, and I developed a lot of confidence in him. But I was always cognizant of the fact that you just really couldn't tell who you could trust over there.
Right.
I mean, I remember when we were at Evans, we had locals from the village come in every day, and they would cut your hair and do your laundry and all that kind of stuff. And I always wondered about that, you know, sitting there in a chair and having this funny-looking little yellow guy with a straight razor working on you. Didn't seem to me to be a good idea. But I figured, well, he's not going to slip my throat in here. But I was a little nervous about that. So I was always a little bit of skepticism about the loyalties of any of them, frankly. And that was all part of my, you know, they're different, they're not us kind of thing.
Right, right. Now, you're approaching your date to leave. This isn't, you're going to leave in October.
Right.
And you're getting a few months away. How much were you cognizant of this fact?
At this point, not yet. I wasn't cognizant at all. I was cognizant of the fact I hadn't been in R&R.
Okay.
I had planned to go to R&R in March. I was going to go to Hawaii and meet my girlfriend. But, of course, I was in that hill then, and that just wasn't possible. So
right.
I didn't do it, and then I thought, well, you know, after we get off, I'll go. But then before I had a chance to schedule it in April, I got India Company.
Mm-hmm.
And that was by far the most rewarding period of my tour. I mean, I loved being a Marine Infantry Company commander in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just felt challenged and fulfilled every day and had developed a strong bond with these troops. I felt that like they were mine. I was responsible for them.
Mm-hmm.
It was up to me to get them home. And, you know, the idea of turning them over to somebody else seemed like betrayal or treason or something.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I was concerned, I was going to do it for the rest of my tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so after we got done doing mountain stuff, then we were operating southwest of Da Nang in sort of what we called the Quezon Valley and Happy
mm-hmm.
Valley. There were sort of big broad valleys down there, and there was plenty of Viet Cong activity there. And we were, for a while when we were operating there, we were, you know, running patrols, running ambushes, and we weren't getting much contact. And then somebody, I can't remember who it was, I don't think it was my idea, but somebody came up with the idea, and we were the first company to implement it with great success,
mm-hmm.
of what we call killer teams.
Mm-hmm.
We would send a platoon patrol through an area, and we would just drop off four guys. So unless somebody was really close and really being careful, they wouldn't notice it. And these guys would just drop off into the brush somewhere, and then they'd sit there till nightfall or as long as it took. And we started triggering successful ambushes on just, you know, one or two or five Kong moving from place to place, doing whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we did that for about a month, most of July. And we never even had a Marine wounded, and I think we ended up with something like 45 KIA or something like that.
Wow. It was very effective.
Very effective, and much more effective than tactics anybody else would have. And that started spreading through our battalion, and I think through the division, frankly.
Mm-hmm. And
was a very effective tactic and was very hard for the Viet Cong to counter.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got toward the end of July, and the powers that be, the colonel and Caulfield, decided that I'd pushed the envelope enough, you know, and
mm-hmm.
it was time to bring me out of the field and give somebody else a chance. So this guy Foley that I've mentioned,
mm-hmm.
I met him at Defense Language Institute West Coast studying Vietnamese before we came. He was a guy I played golf with. And when we got to Vietnam, we got there a couple days apart, and we were both signed to India Company. We were both 326, both to India Company. Initially, he was the 3rd platoon commander, and I was the 2nd platoon commander. And when I became XO, and then after I left, he became XO. And when I came back to India Company, he was very disappointed because he thought he was going to get India Company.
Right.
But they made him the battalion intelligence officer and promised him that he would get his chance. And so they finally decided, and of course he was India Company the whole way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I, they told me that they scheduled me for R&R, and that when I left, Foley was going to take over India Company, and that was like the last couple days of July.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
I chose Sydney because by that time, as I put it, I was real tired of little people with slanted eyes and just wanted to see round-eyed people.
Right.
And so I went to Sydney, and that was great, except that I went in my, you know, summer uniform, summer khaki, short sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Landed at 6 a.m. and it was 32 degrees outside. It was the coldest temperature that had ever been registered in Sydney.
Oh, gosh.
But it warmed up pretty quickly.
Uh-huh.
And they had a great system set up to get you some clothes and get you a hotel. And I really don't remember it very much. I remember the people being very nice. I remember
mm-hmm.
being invited to somebody's home for dinner. But mostly, I think I took a shower about every 3 hours. And I think it was probably 3 days before the
uh-huh.
red dirt stopped coming off.
Uh-huh.
But I enjoyed it very much, and I came back.
Were you by yourself, or did you have somebody?
Yeah, I was basically by myself. I mean, there were a lot of other guys staying in the hotel who were in R&R,
mm-hmm.
but nobody I knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I met them, and we'd have dinner together and go places together and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I played golf there right on the coast, which
mm-hmm.
is a beautiful golf course. Bought a pair of golf shoes. I wore that one time and never since. I gave them away to a friend recently.
Was it weird playing golf? You know,
yeah, the whole
just been in combat?
The whole thing was weird. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think R&R was good, but in a lot of ways, I mean, you know, you'd sort of gotten used to, you'd sort of put real life on hold. You know, troops would think about the world, as we called it, mm-hmm. and what people were doing, but you sort of lost track of the fact that the rest of the world was just living its life normally.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure it was a good idea halfway through to remind people that the rest of the world, life was going on, and
mm-hmm.
most of the world didn't give a shit one way or the other what we did or didn't do, whether we lived or died.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was necessarily good for morale. I guess the two balanced out, probably.
How did it affect you personally?
I think it was good for me in the sense of giving me a chance to, I mean, I did a lot of sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
I think I just got rested up. I mean, the whole time I was in Vietnam, I had always been susceptible to colds. I'm an asthmatic. I didn't tell them that. That's how I got in.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me sometimes. I had, you know, some form of diarrhea most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I never really felt very good. Plus, I was always dead tired. So I think the best thing about it for me was it just gave me a chance to recover physically a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and became the assistant operations officer. Colonel Stute reminded me about my bunker assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed working with Caulfield, who was an outstanding Marine officer. And that's what I did for the rest of the time. And shortly after that, we got a new battalion commander. I remember I got told we had sometime in August, I guess, we were sent to an area called Fugia Pass. It was just north of the village of Lang Co,
mm-hmm.
and that was just north of the Hai Van Pass. The Hai Van Pass was just north of Da Nang. Those mountains that were west of Da Nang jutted out right to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get from Da Nang, Route 1 had to climb over that mountain range.
Mm-hmm.
And the pass was called Hai Van Pass, and Route 1 switched back dozens of times up that mountain and across it and down the other side. And, of course, that was one of the most vulnerable points for Route 1. The NVA could come through the mountains and jungle right up to the edge of the road.
Right.
And so it was ambushed a lot. And so they had a battalion dedicated to keeping Route 1 open across there because that was the only supply line from Da Nang to the rest of the northern provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And we drew that duty. And so the battalion headquarters was put on this side of this mountain overlooking this lagoon. It was an absolutely lovely spot. In fact, subsequently, when I was back in 1998, I saw a mock-up. It was a Japanese company was going to spend $500 million building a resort there.
Mm-hmm.
And tunneling through the mountain. And when I was back this last time, they haven't begun the resort yet, but the tunnel's almost finished.
Mm-hmm.
But we had troops stationed all along Route 1, all across the Hai Van Pass, you know, fire teams every 7,500 yards or whatever,
mm-hmm.
lived up there and guarded it and secured it, basically. And so that's what we were doing. And I was at the battalion headquarters, and I got word one day, Major Caulfield told me to get in the Jeep and go up Route 1 to, I guess it was Don Ha, might have been Clam Tree, and a new battalion commander was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in the Jeep and got a rifleman, and the two of us ran up Route 1 and waited for him, and he came in, and we picked him up. You know, on the way back, we briefed him. I still stay in touch with him. His name was J.W.P. Robertson. He was a piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
He's a first family of Virginia Robertsons, went to VMI, very outgoing, personable, talkative, fun-loving kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells everybody he's ever met since then that his first experience in Vietnam was he got off the helicopter and he saw this totally squared away lieutenant with his flak jacket buttoned and his helmet strap buckled and, you know, what a professional job I did of greeting him and,
mm-hmm.
and briefing him and so forth, and how what a positive spin it gave him on the battalion and how much he knew about the battalion before he even got there and so forth. And so I became sort of his pet.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to play bridge. He would include me in his bridge games in the evenings and
mm-hmm.
did all kinds of crazy things. One time he asked me to fly with him when we got a helicopter, and we flew out to one of the hospital ships that was off the coast of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
the sanctuary with the repose. and chatted up the nurses. And next thing you know, he invites the nurses to come to dinner with us. So he sets this up, and he sends me on a helicopter out to the hospital ship. I pick up six nurses and bring them back and land them on at Fugia Pass, and they have a meal with us, and they go around and treat the troops.
You guys are heroes.
Craziness, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then when one of the officers, probably Caulfield or somebody, was leaving, he decided he wanted to have a mess night, so he made me the charge of the mess night. So, you know, I got prevailed on everybody to scrounge booze and steaks and stuff, and we had this facsimile of a Marine officer's mess night right there on the hill at Fugia Pass.
Hmm.
So that's the way I spent the rest of my time. I remember in September, that part of the coast got hit by a vicious typhoon, and I actually ended up, I mean, it just blew everything away, and just went on for days, 3 days, I think. And I ended up spending that day, there was a little hole in the ground, a bunker, basically, near where I slept, and I ended up sharing that hole with Father Hannigan, the battalion chaplain, who I got to know very well. So I was in there 24 hours, 72 hours with him, couldn't come out. And just as an ironic aside, you know, after I came back, I was at 8th and I in Washington, and I decided to get married. And shortly before I got married, Father Hannigan got assigned as a chaplain at the Navy Yard, and he married us.
Huh.
So that's one of the things I remember from that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And by now, I was getting pretty short.
Right.
And just looking to see whether there was anything else that happened during that period of time. I do remember, I told you I'd like to attend Caulfield's briefing to the new troops. I remember we had a very good view. We were sort of on the side of the hill, and it looked down over this lagoon and down the coast. It was a gorgeous spot. And so I would listen to Caulfield brief these guys. We'd sit up there and do that. And then the chaplain, Father Hannigan, would brief them. And I remember one of the things he would do is there was a dump down off Route 1, well down below us, but you could see it from our spot. And, of course, a lot of our trash was in there. And at any given time, if you looked down there, you could see a bunch of Vietnamese kids prowling around in the dump looking for stuff.
Right.
And so he was talking to these kids about resisting the temptations that might present themselves to them in Vietnam. The way he sort of drew the exclamation point was to say, would you really like to leave here and leave some of your kids down there? The point at that dump. I think he got the message across to the kids pretty well. So that's really the way I spent my last couple of months there. I think it was October 4th, 5th, something like that, was our rotation date. And Foley's was 3 days behind mine. And my mother, somehow or other, Foley's mother, he lived in New Jersey, had gotten, I guess we'd given each other our mother's address, or I guess I was sending my dear friend's letters, my mother was sending to Mrs. Foley. And Mrs. Foley was a very, she was a real worrywart. She was convinced every day that this was going to be the day. And she would call my mother every day. You know, and she'd hear about an action up into the DMZ, and she was convinced we were there. And there'd be one down in the Mekong Delta the next day, and she was convinced we were there. She was driving my mother crazy. But I always had a sort of paternalistic feeling toward Foley. Foley was a brilliant guy, but he just managed to screw things up. I mean, he got kicked out of college for running this gambling operation. He'd broken his arm at the end of basic school. And so all the time we were at Monterey, his arm was healing. And he just, I don't know. I just felt like he needed supervision or help. So I decided I was going to hang around for the extra 3 days to take him along home to make sure he got home. So I did. He tells the story very well of how he was still the company commander of India Company, and they sent him out in operation. Just, in fact, I think it extended past his rotation date, and so I waited. He finally got back in, and he was pissed off because he had the same proprietary feeling toward India Company that I did, and he did not approve of the officer they had selected to take over India Company from him. So he was telling the colonel he wasn't leaving. And so finally the colonel convinced him that this guy would only be in charge of an E company for a couple of days until this new captain arrived and so forth. So Foley said, oh, okay. So one morning the colonel came and got me and said, you guys are going home. And he got in the Jeep and with me and Foley, and we drove over and he said to Foley, get in the Jeep. And he drove us to over Highline Pass to Da Nang. And he had some friend down there who was a senior officer in the air wing. And he prevailed upon him to turn over his quarters to me and Foley for our last night in Vietnam. And he did. And so we got on the Big Bird and went home.
What day was this?
I think it was like October 10, 11, something like that.
How many days past your date had you stayed?
About a week and a half.
Huh. Okay.
Which really pissed off my girlfriend.
Yeah,
She hasn't gotten over it to this day.
Is this the
one? And I exacerbated that further when we arrived at the Air Force Base near Los Angeles. And I had been sort of adopted during my tour over there by this family. I don't know whether I told you about them.
No.
There was this immigrant family. Name was Kaspaul, K-A-S-P-A-U-L. They were from somewhere in Eastern Europe. And they had a son who was in the Marine Corps. He was a sergeant, and he was killed in Vietnam. And Mr. Kaspaul, I don't know exactly what he did, but he was well-to-do. He had a thriving business in Southern California. And for reasons that I can't figure out, but obviously made sense to them, the Kaspaul family decided to, they continued, they had been very active in sending great care packages to their son, all kinds of great stuff in addition to the usual food. I mean, they'd find, you know, pens that had lights on them so you could write at night, and just all kinds of gizmos like that. And they kept sending them to some of his friends after he died. And one thing led to another, and pretty soon they had a mailing list of 10 or 20 Marines that they would send these packages to and write letters and exchange correspondence with. And somehow or other, I got on that list. I don't remember how. And so when they knew I was coming back, they invited me to visit with them for a day. So I certainly felt I owed debt to them, and I did. And they decided, they announced they were going to take us to Disneyland. I thought, wow, you know, here's what I need. Got to go to Disneyland. You know. But actually, it was great. I mean, it couldn't have been better. I mean, we had a day or two at Okinawa to sort of decompress, but now we were landing in the world. And going and spending a day at Disneyland was actually a very good idea. Disneyland was very clean, run beautifully. Everybody was pleasant. Everybody treated us great. I mean, it just really was a sort of uplifting way of being reintroduced to American society. And then there had one of the 12 Marine officers who had been together at language school, Foley was one of them, and Foley and I were together, and one of the other ones, Watts Humphrey, who had been in a class behind me at Yale, was the most seriously injured of the 12 of us. I think I told you that none of us ever got killed. But he was the one that caught the RPG in the right forearm, and he was in the hospital at Camp Pendleton. So we drove down there to visit him. And so we'd been back in country two or three days before we caught our plane home. So we told our parents that we would arrive in Philadelphia aboard flight so-and-so. 1600 or whatever, on, I think it was probably October 14th. And so we get up that morning and we're getting ready to go to the airport, and Foley needs breakfast. We're at the airport. Foley says, I got to have breakfast. I said, come on, they're going to miss the plane. Don't worry, they won't leave without us. Well, they did. By the time we got to the gate, they closed the door.
Oh, boy.
So we missed our flight. So we had to call home and say, we missed our flight. So we caught a later flight, and by the time we got back at the airport, it was not. Nobody was in a particularly good mood. They were pissed. My girlfriend was pissed, first of all, that I had stayed in Vietnam the extra days. She was pissed that we'd spent some time in Los Angeles. She was pissed that we'd missed the plane. She was mad that I hadn't. She had visions of me sneaking back into country and having a romantic tryst with her before my parents even knew I was there. Instead, I called my parents and told them to call her, and she was supposed to come with them to meet me, and that made her mad. Then I got off the plane, and I was a lot lighter, a lot thinner than I'd been. And I had, we had stopped over for a couple hours in Japan on the way home, and I'd made a point of getting the ribbons I knew I deserved and putting them on my uniform. And I'd cultivated this sort of pencil line Errol Flynn mustache, which I thought maybe looked very dashing, which he hated. So it was not a very uplifting experience, either the greeting or the ride home.
Mm-hmm.
It took us a long time to sort of get over all that.
Did you two end up getting married?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Did you have any incidents in any of the airports, any problems coming home?
No incidents at the airport. She was, I believe, a junior at Vassar.
Mm-hmm.
And so during my 30-day leave, I decided to drive up there, and so I put on my uniform and all my ribbons and stuff and went up there, and that was a mistake.
What happened?
Well, it became, there wasn't anything particularly dramatic, but it became very apparent very quickly that I was not welcome. You know, just in subtle but obvious ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew better than to do that again. I didn't. So that was, I went up to Yale to attend a couple football games, and, you know, saw people I'd known before, either professors or in some cases students. And conversation with them was awkward. It wasn't hostile, but it was awkward.
Mm-hmm. Were you in uniform?
No, I'd learned my lesson.
Okay.
But, you know, I was an exception. I mean, there were like 800 kids, 800 guys graduated my class, all of whom were obvious candidates for cannon fodder. I think maybe a dozen of us went, and there was one guy in my class that was killed. And the rest of them, I don't think understood why I would go, why I would join, or approved of the whole thing. And one of the things I never did understand, still don't, was why the protesters, you know, protesting the war and protesting the decisions made in Washington and even protesting the conduct of the war by the generals, I can understand. But why they took it out on the troops, I don't understand.
Right.
I mean, you know, we were just guys who did what we were supposed to do and what our country told us to do. You know? But this, you know, this baby killer stuff and some of the other incidents I've heard about from other people, I mean, it just made no sense to me then and makes no sense to me now.
Do you think the civilian population learned its lesson from that incident?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I certainly observed the very different treatment that the Gulf War people received and that the military receives now. I mean, I guess at a deep level, I sort of resent it, but I'm so pleased to see the military being accepted and received and appreciated by the populace in general, as well as it is now, that far overshadows any minor resentment I might feel. I was peripherally active in helping to get the wall built, and I was there for the dedication in 1982 and took part in the parade. And was absolutely infuriated by, you know, the press coverage that said that this was the country's welcome home we never had. That was total bullshit. I mean, we raised the money from ourselves, we built the damn thing, and we put the parade on for ourselves. I mean, it wasn't the country welcoming us, it was us welcoming each other.
Right.
Which is why, you know, to this day, whenever at a reunion or the wall or anywhere else, one of us sees another identifiable Vietnam vet, we say welcome home.
Right. How many times have you been to the memorial in Washington?
Countless.
What have been your experiences?
It's an amazing place. I mean, the way in which I was involved, you'll recall it, very active protest revolved around Ross Perot against the design.
Yes.
I still don't understand how a female undergraduate at Yale could come up with that design. And as I often do with many works of art, you see things in them that you wonder whether the artist put there, whether the artist knew what they were doing. I find it hard to believe that she could have conceptualized a profound effect this thing would have. But obviously she did a great design. But, you know, it was resisted by the veterans because they said every other monument in the Capitol is white and soaring, and this is black and it's underground. They called it the Black Ditch of Shame. So there was a fairly significant political and emotional battle fought over that, and eventually the compromise was to put the statue of the three soldiers, and it got built. And I think it's a spectacular memorial. I mean, I've been there dozens, maybe hundreds of times. I've been there at every hour of the day or night in every kind of weather, and I have never been alone. There's always somebody there. And, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was... there were, you know, identifiable Vietnam veterans, the ones that wore the camouflage and ponytails and everything else. Some of them just more or less a base or outpost that was always manned. That's not true anymore, but because the Park Service finally kicked them out. But there's always somebody there. I mean, I've been there at 3 o'clock in the morning in a driving snowstorm, and there's somebody else there. And it's very important for me. I mean, I make a point of going there on, you know, Memorial Day and Veterans Day and stuff. I make a point of going there on January 20th every year. And in between, you know, occasionally I'll take some visitor or somebody, but most of the time I go by myself. My office is only about probably less than a half mile from it. And if I'm having a bad day, I'll just walk over there. And, you know, if the pressures of life, the stresses, the strains of life build up on me, I'll just go over there and sit there. And, you know, my favorite time to do it is at night. And over where the statues are, there's a path that runs behind there and some benches, and I'll just go sit on those benches where you can see the wall. And, you know, I don't know why it helps me, but it does. I think what it does is it helps to restore my perspective. You know, whatever's going on that's concerning me or bothering me now, I mean, almost invariably pales into insignificance compared to, you know, the pressures and the responsibilities that I had then. And I mean, there's some way that I can't really explain that I feel the responsibility, I guess, to the guys who didn't make it and whose names are on the wall to not forget them, and I vowed that I wouldn't. One device I did, which has been very successful, was in order to make sure that I thought about them periodically. You know, and most times I don't make trouble with that. I think about them every day, but sometimes time will go by. But one of the things I decided was that every time I hear the national anthem play, that I will think about each one of them individually. And I do that, and that's been very successful in sort of helping me feel like I stay in touch with them. And, you know, I've thought a lot about this, and I don't think that what I have is survivor's guilt, because I don't feel guilty about surviving. At least I don't think so, at least not consciously. But I don't know, there's just some feeling of loss. You know, I think of Mike Thomas. I knew him very well. He was just an outstanding person, just full of life and fun. And you know, you think of what a great father he would have made. What great kids he would have had. You know, you feel like something very important, something very valuable was lost. I spent after about 10 years, I really didn't think much about the war and didn't talk much about it, really until about the time the wall somehow the wall and the experience and the dedication ceremony and everything else sort of put me back in touch with all of this.
Right.
I guess I was ready then.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been very different since then. And about that time, I had promised myself that I would get in touch with Mike's parents,
mm-hmm.
and tell them about him and the way he died. And so I sat down and started writing it, but I never could finish it.
Hmm. Did you ever go talk to them?
No, but when I started writing it, I knew he was from Pawnee, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife decided to find out, put me in touch with his parents. And so she wrote a letter to the high school principal and to the postmaster in Pawnee asking if they knew Mike Thomas's parents and if they were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out Mike Thomas's father is the postmaster.
Wow.
So he wrote back and said yes, and gave him the address and everything. And actually, through that, we ended up getting in touch with his brother. And his brother has actually attended some of our Kathon Veterans Reunions.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. It's not unusual. There are, at the reunions, there are always some family members,
mm-hmm.
of guys who died.
Mm-hmm.
So, she told him that I was going to write this letter and send it to him, which, of course, I didn't get finished. And he told her that to make sure to send it to him at the post office and not to send it to his home,
mm-hmm.
because Mike's mother has never accepted the fact that Mike's dead. She still somehow or other thinks that he's wandering around the jungles over there and someday he's going to come home. I guess they prevailed on her not to open the casket because he got shot right in the forehead with a 50 caliber machine gun, which just basically blew his head apart.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not quite totally accepted that was Mike in there.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to awaken ghosts. So finally, I don't remember exactly when, but a couple years ago, maybe it was after I went back, I did finish the letter and I did send it to him.
Did you hear back from him?
I never actually talked to him directly. He sent a thank you letter and actually sent some clippings of Mike's funeral and stuff like that. But
you've been in contact with his brother, or you've seen his brother at the reunions?
Well, again, I'm not much of a correspondent.
Mm-hmm.
My wife does the corresponding, but I saw him at a reunion, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he actually looks a lot like Mike.
Hmm.
So the wall has been very important for me. I feel almost a proprietary interest in it. I sort of feel like it's my wall.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned from your tour in Vietnam?
Well, the experience clearly made me a better person. My wife knew me before, and she knows me now, and she bears witness to the fact that I grew up, I matured, I became more comfortable with myself and who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I became easier to be around.
That's interesting because you hear some veterans say that the opposite happened to them. Why was it different for you?
I don't know. You know, I've been concerned over the years about the image of the Vietnam vet,
mm-hmm.
all this PTSD and drunkenness and crime and everything else. Are you aware of the book Stolen Valor?
Yes, sir.
I mean, that was a really welcome book for me and a lot of them, my family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always felt like the image of the Vietnam vet was way overdone. And so the research that they did and the numbers that they gave and the anecdotes that they told and all that sort of thing just sort of made me feel that my gut impression was right and that a lot of the bad press and bad PR that the Vietnam vet has gotten wasn't deserved and wasn't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know exactly why. I mean, I think most Vietnam veterans adjusted very well. Mm-hmm. And sure, there are always going to be some people who have a more adverse reaction, but that's been true in any war. Why some react better than others, I don't know. Now, it's interesting to me that at every reunion I've been to, there's always been a presentation or a seminar or whatever on PTSD.
Yes, sir.
And I'd never gone to any of them. You know, my feeling has always been that that's for those weak people. But this last one, because one of the guys I knew was wanted to go and was going, and I didn't have anything else to do,
mm-hmm.
I went. And I was really very much impressed and amazed. I mean, they had three guys there who stood up and talked about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they presented themselves, you know, they said that, and they had the same kind of attitude toward this whole thing, PTSD, as I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, couldn't be me. I'm too strong for that. Yada, yada, yada. And they described themselves and the thoughts, processes that they went through and their experiences. And for most of them, there was an emotional deterioration that led to, often to a particular event that made them realize that they needed help.
Mm-hmm.
And they went and got help. And the message they were trying to give us is, remember, this is to a group, a meeting of the Quezon Veterans Reunion.
Mm-hmm.
They said, if you were at Quezon and you don't think you have PTSD, you're wrong. It's just a question of how severe and how it has affected you. And the message they were trying to get across was that there's help out there for it.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, they would, one of them said, I put this presentation on at a reunion or whatever in which most of the guys had their wives there. And there were actually quite a few wives at this one. And he said, what we did was we put the veterans on chairs in the first row, and we put their wives behind them, and then we started describing some of the symptoms and behaviors typical of PTSD. And he said, as we ticked off each one, all the vets in the front row were shaking their head no, and all the wives behind them were shaking their head yes.
Hmm.
He said, if you don't think you have PTSD, ask your wife. My wife's been trying to convince me for years that I could benefit from facing up to some of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually toying with the idea of exploring that, but I haven't quite gotten there yet.
So you don't believe that you have suffered from any kind of PTSD?
Well, it certainly has not incapacitated me in any realistic way.
Right.
I think it has, if it has affected me, and I think maybe it has,
mm-hmm.
It's in my interpersonal relationships. And I just never related that to the war or the PTSD. I thought that was just me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am who I am. I'm a kind of an iconoclast, and I'm a little bit of a loner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just don't value insignificant and social human interactions very much, and so I don't engage in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that meant there was anything wrong with me. I just thought that was part of me. But
mm-hmm.
but after listening to these guys, I recognize some of my idiosyncrasies and behaviors in some of the things they were talking about. And they said, you know, if you could walk into a bar, he says, it's that guy down there sitting down at the end of the bar by himself drinking his beer. I mean, I'm the kind of guy, if I go to a bar, I hate going to cocktail parties because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've got no time for making small talk with people I don't know. I don't care what they think about the weather. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe some of that is part of the residual effects of that experience. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's almost hard to believe that you could have that kind of an experience and not have some residual effects.
Right.
I've always sort of wondered why it didn't bother me more. I mean, and now, of course, as you can tell from when I was talking a while ago, talking about it, thinking about it, reading articles about the wall or something, moves me to tears.
Yes.
Of course, I'm the kind of guy that, you know, until 20 years ago, I hadn't cried since I was a child. And, thought strong guys don't do that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of matured and grown over that, I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was, I proved I was a tough guy in Vietnam. I proved to myself and everybody else I don't have anything to prove in that regard anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started having to wear reading glasses and I kept losing them all the time, I finally got myself a granny string and hung them around my neck, and I do everywhere I go. And I figure, who's going to tell me, you know, who's going to make fun of me for that?
Mm-hmm. Right. I commanded a company in Vietnam.
Right. So that's the main thing. I don't know whether you call that learning something. I learned something about myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's the main residual effect of my experience.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot, and you heard me talk earlier about the resiliency of the human beings.
Yes.
I mean, I'm convinced that human beings, if they are motivated to do so, if they are survivors and want to survive, can survive virtually anything.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that long ago we heard about this guy, I don't remember what the hell happened to him, that cut off his leg to free himself from a rock or something, like a mountain climber.
Cut off his arm.
Arm, yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, most people think, oh, God, you know, I couldn't do that. Well, I didn't think I could withstand 77 days of caseline.
Right.
But I did. People, you know, I've talked about Vietnam. I've always carried a grudge, if you will, with respect to my college classmates.
Mm-hmm.
I was in law school when the Cali trial was going on,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote an impassioned letter to the school newspaper in which I pointed out that, I said, first of all the people who are screaming for Cali's head weren't there. They didn't experience the incredible frustration of watching your troops get blown away by booby traps and having nobody to retaliate against, and knowing that the person who did it is over there in that village.
Mm-hmm.
I said, every one of us wanted to go over there and torch that village, but the leaders wouldn't permit it. I wanted to do it too, but I mean, I knew we couldn't. I knew it was wrong, and I couldn't let my troops do it. And they knew that. Cali clearly wasn't strong enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Cali shouldn't have been a lieutenant. If all of my classmates at Yale and the ones at Princeton and Harvard had joined the service and become the officers they should have been, Cali would have been a corporal. And he would have been, they would have helped in telling him what to do, and that wouldn't have occurred. And those were the guys that were screaming the loudest for his scalp. And I sort of pointed that out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interim at reunions at Yale, I've unburdened myself of that opinion occasionally. And the last two times we've gotten together, actually, we've had discussions on Vietnam, which were, first of all, much better attended than I thought they would be. And
mm-hmm.
the interchange was interesting and valuable. But I certainly... felt then and feel now that, in fact, I said to my wife, I said, you know, most of these guys 30, 40 years from now are going to be ashamed, because they were raised in the same country I was, and they were raised basically the same values I was, and, you know, the reason I didn't use my asthma or blood pressure or any of the other things that would have kept me out physically was I just, you know, it would have been damaging to my psyche to be 4F.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't want to think of myself as, you know, too delicate to go or something. So I, you know, not only didn't gin something up, I avoided telling them about things I knew would keep me out. And I just truly believed, and I still do, and events have worn me out in many cases, that those guys at some point in the dark of the morning would take counsel with themselves and be ashamed of the extent to which they went, or the fact that they didn't volunteer to go, and
mm-hmm.
it denied the military their talents and skills, which would have been very valuable.
Do you think that has happened?
Yes, I know it has for some of them. The best expression of it I've seen is by Pat Conroy.
Mm-hmm.
You know who he is?
Yes, the author.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Know him very well.
Ragged Words, Great Lantini.
Yeah, I know him very well.
He wrote an essay or an article or something that passed around the internet a couple of years ago.
On the death of his father?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, was there a separate one in which he talked about, he was writing a book about the Citadel basketball team?
That's his most recent book, My Losing Season.
And he went around, I think the article I'm talking about now, the one of his father, I remember it was very moving, but
mm-hmm.
I think this one was... He went around, and one of the guys that was on the basketball team that he interviewed, had been to Vietnam, and that got them into this thing. And Conroy then wrote this sort of reflective piece in which he sort of came to grips with his relationship with his father, his avoidance of service in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and the interplay with this fellow basketball player,
mm-hmm.
which was exactly the kind of reaction that I had predicted and I thought was a very eloquent expression of it. He's obviously a very talented writer.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I've had some of these people say that. And, you know, what got me started in that was in each one of these interchanges at Yale reunions, as people would speak and rebut, if you will, points I had made,
mm-hmm.
they would almost invariably begin by saying, you know, Tom, I couldn't have done what you did, but. And after a while, I got tired of hearing that, and I stopped them, and I said, you know, I'm tired of hearing that. I said, you could have done it, and you would have done it, because what choice did you have?
Mm-hmm.
What was I going to do? I couldn't run away. I could have shot myself, but that's the only alternative. And the reason people react and accomplish and do things that they don't think they could have is because they don't have any choice. They've got to.
Mm-hmm.
And the human mechanism and the human mind are amazingly adaptive.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about going back to Vietnam. Why did you go back initially?
Well, I sort of toyed with the idea. I told you before about the unsatisfactory state of my attitude toward the Vietnamese people. And that always bothered me when I left. That always bothered me because, you know, Mike Thomas and these guys had died for trying to make a better life for these people. I mean, I guess really we were doing it to stop communism for our own benefit, but, I mean, while you were there, you sort of felt like you were trying to protect these people from a bunch of bad guys and make a better life for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so having a very negative feeling toward them as a whole didn't seem right and didn't fit and bothered me. And then as I met some of them over here and sort of started overcoming that, at least on individual bases, I thought that it might be worthwhile to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But there were just, you know, feelings that I couldn't put in words and I couldn't understand that held me back. And I started, you know, seeing advertisements for military historical tours and a couple other units that specialized in these kinds of things and put them together and did all the arrangements. And, you know, I've become a guy who likes my creature comforts, and I figured I didn't want to go back there and that hot, smelly, awful place.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then Colonel Warren Weedhan, who's a retired Marine and who runs military historical tours, always tries to get some well-known figure to sort of highlight each tour. And as they were putting together this 30th anniversary of the Siege of Quezon, remembrance of Quezon kind of thing, he got Carl Mundy, the retired commandant,
mm-hmm.
to headline it. And, of course, I told you Mundy was the guy I reported to when I went into 326 way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of encouraged me to, you know, I called him and asked him, and he said, encouraged me to go along. So finally I said, what the hell? If I'm not going to do it now, I'm never going to do it, and it'd be fun to go back with Carl. And then I told my friend, I have a friend, Jay French, who lives close to me. He's a lawyer in Washington. He was in my class at Yale. This is a great story. I'd never met him at Yale. He was a Navy ROTC at Yale, and I never met him. He got out of Yale and went in the Marine Corps. He was at Quezon. He was in the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines, so he was in the same regiment I was.
Mm-hmm.
He came back to Washington after get out of Quezon. He got out of the Marine Corps, and he went to law school. He went to GWI. Went to Georgetown University. He had then worked for Vice President Ford and was working in the White House. I worked in the White House after I got back to Vietnam while I was in the Marine Corps. And so we had all these commonalities, and but we'd never met.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife's college roommate had worked with Jay at the Vice President's office, and so she introduced us, and we quickly became fast friends. And so when I was going back, I didn't think Jay would want to go, but I told him about it, and he decided to go. So he and I and I knew Monday, but I didn't know anybody else. But the dynamics of a group like that and how quickly they get to know each other and become friends under those circumstances is kind of fun and interesting. And we went back and all enjoyed it very, very much. But that's why I went.
Where did you go?
Well, we were required to go to Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
So we landed in Hanoi, and I was not looking forward to that. I thought Hanoi would be a great rim capital, and you know, it's run by the commies and all that. It's actually a very lovely city. Sort of has a lot of old French colonial atmosphere and buildings and parks and so forth. The people were cordial but reserved. I remember right after we got there, we got to the hotel. And
where did you stay? Do you remember which hotel?
I have it written down somewhere, but
okay.
I can't remember. And it was, you know, sort of, it wasn't one of the big ones. It was just sort of a tourist kind of hotel, but it was perfectly comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only a block or two from what they call the old quarter. And so we had an hour or two before dinner, and we had been told not to wander off by ourselves, but I've never recorded that. I still run patrols in parts of Washington I'm not supposed to go through. I think Vietnam addicted me to risk, so I have to seek it out once in a while. So I decided to strike off by myself. She took a nap and I went walking into the quarter. And, you know, this is right after we got there. I mean, when you first get there, you don't actually have flashbacks, but seeing these people and knowing you're in North Vietnam and knowing they were the enemy is very off-putting. I mean, I really was nervous. I really felt like I was running a patrol, you know, or something. And I walked over there in the old quarter, and it's about supper time, and these buildings are all packed together, and there's lots of people living in there, and there's fairly wide sidewalks and narrow streets. And I'm walking around, and it's a warm day, and they're all out on the street getting ready for dinner. They're cooking dinner right there on the street. The whole family's there. And so the sidewalks are clogged with people. And I have to step over a lot of these people. I'm just walking right through them. And here I am, you know, this 6-foot-tall, probably they could tell I was American, but I obviously stand out like a sore thumb, and nobody's even looking at me. Nobody caught my eye. Nobody, they just ignored me. Occasionally, you know, as I walked through some little kids playing, one of them would sort of look up and look at me funny, but totally ignored me, which I found kind of interesting and bizarre, and totally different than it was in South Vietnam when we got there. So we were in there, and we went, you know, to see Uncle Ho, and they told us not to make any wisecracks, and we went to our military museum, where it's got all these shot down jets and their version of things, which is totally propagandistic. And then from there, we flew down to Da Nang and worked our way up to Dong Ha by bus, up Route 1, which was quite an experience. I was sitting in the shotgun seat, and, you know, it's just an amazing. I mean, the traffic dynamic on Route 1 is just amazing. And then from Da Nang, or Dong Ha, we worked our way west on Route 9 to Kaesan. In 1998, that trip took us 2 hours and 45 minutes. In 2003, it took us 45 minutes. Because they were working on the road then. They were straightening it out and you know, doing culverts and everything else. They've really improved it. Route 9 is now probably the best road in Vietnam. And so we went out to the combat base. We could not. When we went to the combat base, there was a cement marker there that basically celebrated the tremendous victory of the People's Army over the United States and their puppets. But that was all. And we did not get a chance to go to 881 because you couldn't get a helicopter. You can't get a helicopter in Vietnam. And you can't get any cars or trucks or buses up there. And we didn't have time to walk. So we sort of viewed it from afar. When we went down to the Long Vay Special Forces Camp, we could just barely see it in the corner. And I knew we would be able to because I remember on the night of February 4th and 5th, I think it was, when that Special Forces Camp was overrun, first time the enemy used tanks, we heard the tanks, and we actually observed the bombing run next morning that chased the tanks back into Laos. So that was the only glimpse I got. I could tell the hill was still there and had some grass on it, but that's all I could tell, and that was one of the things that I missed, and that's why I went back the second time. But you know, we went around to Con Tien and Leatherneck Square and Camp Carroll and all these different places.
How was it being back for you there?
Initially, I was nervous, especially when we were, you know, like walking out in the rice paddies or the trails.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I immediately reverted back to a high state of alert and scanning for tripwires and signs and anything unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very uncomfortable that first time. I mean, by the time we'd been there, we were there probably almost 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the time, I think I was adjusting to that. But at first, I just was on total alert. You know, everything was potentially lethal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was discomforting. But I got over that. And it's funny because when I went back a second time, I didn't have any of that, but I noticed it in the guys who were going for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sort of a natural reaction, I guess.
On your second trip, did you get to 881?
Yes.
What was that like? What'd you do?
Well, the trip over, as you probably can guess, if you've done it, you know, is arduous.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of hours in planes, and you know, by the time you get there, you're tired, exhausted, and jet-lagged, and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, we landed in Hanoi, but we didn't stay there. We visited Hanoi on the way at the end of the trip. So once we got to Hanoi, we got on another airplane, and we were supposed to fly into Fubai, but things were late, so the Fubai airport had closed, so we flew into Da Nang, and we got on a bus and took the five-hour bus trip. So, I mean, it was all part of the same trip, and we finally got to Dong Ha. And then the next morning, we went to Khe Sanh. So we went out Route 9, and we, you know, went to the combat base, which now has a museum and more propaganda and an old U.S. tank that they have set at the entrance and signs pointing you toward this historical point of interest. And we went to Long Vay, and then we stayed overnight in Khe Sanh Village. And Khe Sanh guest house is very humble.
Mm-hmm.
But we stayed there, and then at 0:30 we got up and prepared to hike to the hill. Now, I knew that we were going to walk up, and I knew it was going to be rigorous. And so I had worked pretty hard at getting myself in shape. A couple times a day I would go down to the garage and hike up the 14 flights of stairs to my office and
mm-hmm.
otherwise get myself in better physical condition because I knew it was going to be difficult. But I wasn't even 40% in the shape I should have been.
Hmm.
I mean, it just kicked my ass.
Hmm.
We got on these little buses, and we went through what are now the suburbs of Khe Sanh,
mm-hmm.
and drove out to this Montagnard village. And we picked up our guide there. The guide was the chief of the village and a couple of his henchmen. And so they took us out there, and we hiked through some rice paddies and then up over the shoulder of a hill and down again, which gave us a little bit of the feel for how difficult it was going to be to climb.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to the base of 881 and climbed up. And by the time we started climbing up, it was hot, although we drew a very good day, really. It wasn't as hot as normal, and it wasn't as humid as normal, and it was a breeze. But, I mean, it would just climb, 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 and you figure, well, you know, how hard can it be? Put one foot in front of the other, you take your time. I mean, it just was hard. You know, we were carrying our own water and stuff, so we were carrying gear, but not as much as we carried then. And about two-thirds of the way up, I started experiencing definite signs of heat exhaustion,
mm-hmm.
Shivers and chills and
mm-hmm.
all that sort of thing. And by this time, there were, I believe, 13 of us trying to make it up there. It was a smaller group. And several had dropped out already.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, I could tell, that I should drop out. But I just couldn't bring myself to.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of fell behind the rest of them for a while. And then they stopped. They found a little copse of trees, and they stopped there. So I got there and laid down my back. And after about 20 minutes, they decided to start moving up, and I got up to go with them, and I was just so dizzy, I fell back down.
Mm.
So I said, I'm just going to wait here for a while. You guys go, and if I can make it, I'll make it. And so after another 20 minutes or so, I decided I was going to try to make it up there, so I walked the rest of the way by myself. And, you know, every step was agony, but I wanted to get there, so I
mm-hmm.
did. And so we get up to the top, and it was pretty recognizable. I mean, then there had been no vegetation, just the red dirt. Now there's most places 3 or 4 feet of elephant grass and assorted other bushes and stuff, but no trees. The big bomb craters are still apparent. Even though it's overgrown, if you know where to look, you can find the trench line and some of the bunkers. I found the bunker I lived in without much problem.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I did when I got there was go from the big hill where India Company was down to the smaller hill where my company was, because somehow or other I understood that one of the reasons I wanted to go there was, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the two gunnies are still there. I mean, I think I told you on February 23rd I lost the two gunnies on one round.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were in a small foxhole, and that round went in there, and it just made mush of them. I mean, we found nothing, basically. We shoveled a couple shovelfuls of bloody mud into the bags and sent them home, but for all practical purposes, 90% of their molecules are still there. And as far as I'm concerned, that's where they were buried. That's where they live. It's a toss-up between that moment, the moment when they died, and the death of Mike Thomas, as to which was the most singular, traumatic, and emotional moment in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably was Thomas because I was watching,
mm-hmm.
and that was the instant in which I realized that we were playing for keeps. I mean, up until then, you sort of feel like if it really got bad, you could call timeout or something, you know?
Right.
But that sort of drove home the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But losing those two gunnies and leaving me up there by myself with those guys, I still remember the feeling, and it was not a good one. And so I mourned that loss ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people talk about, or everybody would say, are you going over there for closure? And I'd say, no, I don't need closure. But maybe in this one respect, with respect to them, maybe that's what I was looking for. I don't know. But, I mean, I knew I could find the hole because it was in the bottom of this 2,000-pound bomb crater, which obviously was still going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, once I found my bunker, I knew where to go to find that one, and I did. And, you know, it was there. It was bit of grass growing in it. There were some lovely little flowering plants with little purple flowers
mm-hmm.
all around it. And I, you know, crawled down in there and found the hole. You know, said a prayer. It was kind of unfortunate. I had bought a new camera to go over there, a
mm-hmm.
lovely little tiny little Sony thing that does, it's digital and it does video and stills, and the stills on these memory sticks that are like a stick of chewing gum, so
mm-hmm.
and it just had all kinds of gizmos. It was really neat. So I was really, and I lugged it up there, but it was new to me, and I wasn't familiar with how long the battery lasted, and I exhausted the battery before I got there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any of my own pictures from up there, but the tour guide and his son, who was along, walked down there that hill with me, and they took some pictures, so I've got a couple pictures of. Yeah, not very dramatic. It's just a bunch of grass and a hole in the ground. It means something to me.
Of course.
And so then I went back up and joined the rest of the guys on the higher part of the hill. And Frank Gulledge, who was the webmaster of the Purple Foxes and whose idea this tour had been, was with us. And he had made a sort of an 8.5 by 11 plaque that on the one side listed the guys who had died up there, and on the other side had some of Dave Powell's pictures, and he'd have it laminated and so forth, and we decided we were going to leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
And he had asked me to do the honors. And so actually I had been carrying it up there, and Frank is one of the guys. Frank is well into his 60s, and he's one of the guys who didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And what looked like I might not make it, I gave it to Owen Matthews, who was along. Owen's the guy who was the 2nd Platoon Commander after Mike Thomas, and the guy who blew the bugle for the
mm-hmm.
flags and stuff. And I had met him at a reunion, and he heard about this, and he said he wanted to go, but he wasn't going to go unless I went because he wouldn't know what the hell he was doing or where he was. He needed a guide. So he went along, and he was along up, and I gave it to him. I said, if I don't make it up there, you got to do this. So when I got there, he gave it back to me, and we went over, and we found a little hole, one of the holes. And there was actually an angle iron sticking out of it that we lashed the remembrance to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure If the authorities knew what we were doing, they would have been unhappy.
Of course.
I suspect it's going to be a while before the authorities find it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I made a little speech and we said a little prayer. And when I go in the first time, in the Hong Kong airport, Jay French and I had bought a fifth of Remy Martin cognac.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept it along, and we used it to offer a toast to Case on and so forth. And I thought that was a great idea, so I did the same thing this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had put some of the cognac into a soda, small empty soda bottle and packed it. And I had forgotten about it when I got up there because when I left that copse of trees, I left my pack and everything there. But I had this in my side pocket, cargo pant pocket. And then, so just as we were leaving the hill, I remembered it, and we passed it around and offered a toast. And then we had to go back down. Every step I took up, I said, God, I got to come back down this way.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, gravity helps, but when you're as exhausted as I was, just keeping the brakes on all the way down was
mm-hmm.
difficult. So I just, you know, took it a step at a time and took my time, and we made it.
Hmm.
And on that hike, I drank 5 liters of water and 1 liter of Gatorade and never urinated.
Wow.
I mean, you know you're not as good a shape now as you were when you were 24, but the difference is much, much worse than I thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we got down to the village, and so we had to go through a little ceremony with the chief, you know, 40 years old. I don't think he broke a sweat. he did it in his shower shoes.
Uh-huh. I believe you.
Unbelievable. And so we went back to his house, and he has this nice big house, you know, Bruce style, up on stilts, thatch roof. The floor, there's cross beams, and then the floor is covered with split bamboo. It's not even fastened down. We were being very careful that we didn't punch through it because we were a lot heavier than they were. So we're in there, and he's got his television and his color television and his stereo and his 6 or 8 kids and his wife. And we all sat around in there and sort of, we brought some stuff along to give to him, mainly for the kids, school supplies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He went and got some of his best sake and passed that around, and we met his wife and kids. And,
mm-hmm.
and as we were leaving, I remembered that I had probably about 6 or 8 ounces of that cognac, and I asked the guide whether we had a local guide along, in addition to our former, you know, our guy that worked for the tour company.
Mm-hmm.
We had local interpreter Vietnamese guides. We always assumed, and I think we're right, that they, if not government security people, they certainly report to them. But they're really nice guys, and they're educated, and they're very helpful. And I asked him whether it would be appropriate to give that to the chief, and he said yeah, so I left that with the chief.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it took us all day to do that. And then we hopped on these buses, and we were exhausted, and drove back to Dong Ha that night. It was, I'm glad I did it.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd have known how physically arduous it is, I probably wouldn't have tried it. But I'm glad I did it, and I'm certainly glad I made it to the top.
I can imagine so. Let me ask a couple questions about today's remembrances of Vietnam and how the public sees the Vietnam War. First, what do you think about the movies that have been made about the Vietnam War?
I think most of them have had enough weirdness in them that it reinforces the stereotype of the, you know, drugged out, mentally deranged Vietnam
mm-hmm.
veterans. I mean, there were aspects, for example, Apocalypse Now, I thought that putting aside the speakers and Robert Duvall's infatuation with surfing,
mm-hmm.
but that the presentation of that attack on that village
mm-hmm.
is very realistic. There are parts of Full Metal Jacket that are very realistic. Platoon, there are scenes in there that I identified with. But, you know, all of those have this overarching message of wrongness, futility, and weirdness that I think colors and reinforces the society's generally negative image of the Vietnam veteran. And I think inaccurate. I think it's unfair. I think it's unfortunate.
What about "We Were Soldiers"?
Yeah, I had read the book before I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was pretty good. Somehow or other, I don't remember exactly what my criticisms were, but I had some.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't satisfy me as being exactly right. But, yeah, in terms of giving the feeling of the chaos in those frenetic moments of combat, yeah, it was very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably one of the best. You know, when I came back, I sort of planned on and thought I owed it or ought to write a book, and I sort of felt bad that I never quite got started because I really didn't know how to get started.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim Webb wrote Fields of Fire, and
mm-hmm.
I read it. You know, it's not exactly my experience, and it's not exactly the story I would have told, but it basically told the story well enough that I felt like, if I wanted to write a book, fine, but I didn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
I felt relieved of the duty. And there, he's participating himself in the making of a movie on that right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I hold great hope that will be the Vietnam War movie, or at least the one that comes closest to my experience.
Mm-hmm. What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned in Vietnam and from the experience?
Not very many. At least in word, the Powell Doctrine, if you will,
mm-hmm.
of not committing Americans to a combat situation or a potential combat situation without knowing why we're going there and what constitutes victory and having an exit strategy,
mm-hmm.
Certainly is the most profound and most important lesson we learned. But I hear it spoken, but I don't necessarily see it applied in all situations. It certainly wasn't applied in Somalia, and Powell was actually had some role in at least the initial incursion into that country, which
mm-hmm.
was supposed to be just a humanitarian effort, but got subjected to mission creep. And even looking where we are in Iraq today, you know, the press kept screaming Vietnam, Vietnam. To the point where I was tired of hearing it, but even before the combat ended, the answers I heard from the White House and the Defense Department sounded an awful lot like, to me, like what we heard in Vietnam from the White House and the
mm-hmm.
Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, we're in a situation that I don't care whether they want to call it a guerrilla war or not, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't know how we're going to get out. And there's talk of, well, we can't do it with 150,000 troops. We need another 100,000 troops.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds an awful lot like Vietnam to me.
Yes, sir.
And you know, I'm not casting stones at anybody, but, I mean, I think that Lyndon Johnson and McNamara and McGeorge Bundy and even Walt Rostow, I think they were fine human beings. And I think that they were smart and well-intentioned, and they were doing their best. I don't think they were evil people. I just think they got sucked into a situation that initially they didn't understand,
mm-hmm.
and then they couldn't get out of. They couldn't find a way out of it that was satisfactory on a both military and political basis.
Mm-hmm.
And looks an awful lot like the situation we're in right now in Iraq.
Yes, sir.
I don't know how the hell we're going to get out. We can't just pull out and let the thing crater. We've created a mess. We've got to clean it up. We are not have not been very adept, at least so far, in doing it to the satisfaction of the people there. We're sort of cramming our Western solutions down their throats.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do question how much we learned about it. One thing we obviously learned was not to just turn the media loose on the war. This controlling reporters and embedding them and all that kind of stuff is obviously an attempt to prevent the kind of free-form reporting that was so damaging in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I approve of that. I don't have any problem with that. But I think the major lesson we learned about being very careful about committing troops is one that I still have questions about whether we really learned it or not,
mm-hmm.
or whether we need to relearn it. And, you know, Americans are like that. I mean, whoever it was that said those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it, it applies to Americans, it applies to politicians. I mean, even Clinton in his scandal, I mean, if he hadn't learned, why hadn't he learned what everybody else knew about Nixon and his problem?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't the initial act that caused the problem. It was the cover-up.
Right.
It was the denial. He didn't learn it. In Vietnam, you know, we had this 13-month for Marines and 12-month for everybody else tour.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was good in the sense that it was, you know, if you were subjected to those conditions and it was never-ending, that probably would have been had a significantly adverse effect on morale. But what it really did was mean we had to keep relearning the same lessons in combat over and over, and we didn't learn them.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've been back, as I told you, I've read a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've read... I can give you three books that talk about American battalions walking into a regimental ambush a year or more apart and within 100 meters of the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have pictures of these NVA regiments saying, here they come again.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, you know, do a replay of the, including the one the 326 walked into in September of 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why did each new battalion commander or each new regimental commander have to learn the same lesson the same hard way? I mean, we made efforts to pass on information and lessons learned and all that sort of thing, but that lack of continuity in command was devastating and was very expensive. When you, you know, it went on for 6 or 7 years, and people never apparently got the word. It's kind of frustrating, but... it still goes on.
What would you tell the younger generation today about the Vietnam War?
Well, I think my primary lesson, I still feel almost a responsibility to my troops to try to, since I'm a little more educated and a little more articulate and have a little better access than they do,
mm-hmm.
to try to spread the message that they're not all a bunch of losers.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all a bunch of baby killers. I mean, when I got Stolen Valor, I ordered probably 50 copies and sent them around to people I thought ought to read them, including,
mm-hmm.
including people in the press and people in Congress, and said, you know, you guys created this image. It's up to you to get it right. And, of course, I don't think it's had much effect. So that's one thing I would talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't think I told you. Earlier this year, before I went to Vietnam, I was having my hair cut at the barbershop at the Watergate, and I noticed a book bag sitting there, and sticking out of the top of the book bag was a book called After Tet,
mm-hmm.
which is a book written by Ron Spector, which I had read. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and I looked over and saw this kid that probably was a GW college student, and I thought it was probably his. So as he got ready to leave, I said, are you reading that book? And he said, yeah. I said, why are you reading it? He said, oh, it's required in this course I'm taking on the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, really? I said, who's the professor? He said, Mr. Spector. So I was kind of curious that there was, because my experience has been that most of the younger generation don't even know anything about the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they don't know what it was. They don't know why we were there. Their ignorance is colossal.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, Jan Scruggs people, have been come up with a an educational package that they've mailed to high school teachers, high school history teachers and stuff, and they encourage veterans to get involved in that. And I've sort of toyed with that idea, but I've never done it because until recently I lived in Montgomery County, and Montgomery County is as liberal and a place as you could imagine, and I'm already so much out of touch with all those people, I didn't think there was any point in accentuating it because I didn't think they would appreciate me having me talk to their kids about the Vietnam War anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't really done that, but I did contact Spector and say, Jim, surprised that there's a class, a college class on the Vietnam War. I'd like to monitor it if you don't mind. And he said, well, the university has a policy that unless you're an alumnus, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason you couldn't come talk to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we set a date shortly after I got back from Vietnam, and I went over there to the class.
Mm-hmm.
The main reason I went over is I sort of wanted to see who these kids were and find out why they were taking this class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. You know, some of them, several of them, they were taking it because they had a relative who'd been there or who hadn't come back from there. Others sort of saw some parallels between the circumstances then
mm-hmm.
and circumstances now and wanted to learn more about it to see whether that was correct or not. I think some of them were, all of them, I think, knew about and had heard about in many different respects the 60s and how strange and weird and different they were
mm-hmm.
and wanted to get tuned in a little better to that whole thing because I think young people recognize that the young people, the students, and the demonstrators played a significant role in both politics and in the conclusion of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of is a beacon to them. And, you know, instead of feeling totally ignored and frustrated, it's an example of the fact that maybe they do have a little bit of power, maybe they can be listened to under the right circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're interested in finding out more about that. So, I mean, I went over there figuring I was just going to observe Spector and his class.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, he introduced me and turned it over to me. So I just, you know, told him a little bit about what I'd done and told him about my trip that I just completed going back. And then they asked me a bunch of questions. And it was a thoroughly enjoyable afternoon.
That's good. Well, Tom, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about or anything that we have not covered that you want to discuss?
Let me see. I think I got most of my individual stories. Well, here's one that I didn't.
Okay.
I told you about my refusal to obey that order, that major, and getting away with it.
Yes, sir.
Again, you know, I'd always been sort of unhappy with the 1st Division because I felt like when we got there, they just shunted us out into the mountains where none of them would go and then forgot about us. And so coming back to Hill 55, I think it was, it could have been Hill 10, one of the regimental bases there,
mm-hmm.
after we'd been out in the jungle for like 4 weeks, we'd flown back and we were getting there in helicopters. We landed in the helicopter pad and we were walking up the hill away from the pad. And as I was walking up the hill, I saw this Marine captain standing there, you know, mm-hmm. clean pressed utilities, shine boots.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something to my gunnery sergeant about, very critical about our appearance. You know, whose troops are these? They're a disgrace. They're, you know, to the Marine Corps or something like that. And we were a pretty disreputable looking group of guys. I mean, we've been out there for a long time. Utilities were dirty and soiled and torn.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were wearing non-regulation caps and so forth. And we were dirty. And so I sort of, the gunny went over and was explaining to this guy what was going on. And this guy, I was sort of standing behind the gunny, listening to the gunny and him talk. And this guy said that this is, that's no excuse. This is an outrage, yada, yada, yada. And he just went on and on in a very high and mighty kind of tone. And then he looked at me and said, and are you responsible for these people? And I said, yes. And he just started in on me. So I just lost it. I jumped him and put my thumbs on his windpipe, knocked him to the ground, and was trying to choke him.
Uh-huh.
And that gunny pulled me off. I mean, I just wasn't going to take that shit from him.
What was his rank?
He was a captain. I was a lieutenant.
Okay.
Gunny pulled me off, and that was the end of it. I never heard any more about it. But if the gunny hadn't pulled me off, I might very well have finished him off right there.
This is in front of your men.
Yeah.
So they could see that you would absolutely stick up for them.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm just looking here at the notes I made last night. I think we've covered most everything.
Okay.
I got a few. Oh, here's one that was fun. This goes all the way back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You remember I was 3 months behind the rest of my basic school class and going to Vietnam because of the Defense Language Institute, the Vietnamized language.
Yes, sir.
So I was going through Okinawa in September, early September, and I was walking along the side of the road, and all of a sudden this Jeep to a halt, and two guys jump out and say, Esslinger, we heard you were dead. Two guys from my basic school class who had been to Vietnam and had been wounded and were back in Okinawa,
mm-hmm.
and they'd heard that I was dead. Well, it turned out that during that summer, there had been an Esslinger killed, a Lance Corporal Esslinger. His name's on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not a very common name, so the word got around that Esslinger had been killed. That was before I'd even gotten there. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Yes.
I talked earlier about the effect of the B-52 strikes on the enemy. Normally, they would not drop B-52 strikes closer than 3,000 meters to friendlies
mm-hmm.
because these planes are flying at 30,000 feet and just a minor miscalculation up there could cover a lot of territory. But when we were on the hill, there was a ridge just to our west about 800 meters away. And the enemy clearly lived up. Well, I mean, they lived right up. We knew they lived right up to our wire, because at night, the closer they could get to our wire, the safer they were from our harassment and interdiction fires.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that they had taken over the water point at the bottom of the hill that we used to use for water. So they were everywhere. But as part of the intelligence, they had, that was when they began dropping those spikes that had sonic devices on them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of activity. They would send a radio signal back, and they also flew helicopters around that measured, we called them people sniffers. They had a pod and then those of the helicopter that would sniff the air and measure it for nitrogen, uric acid content.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got a concentration of it, they knew that the enemy was massing, and they had apparently gotten a pretty heavy reading on this ridgeline one night. And, of course, we had no advance notice, and it was the middle of the night, and I just happened to be lying out on top of the bunker just because wanted to get some air, wanted to get out of the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just lying up there, and all of a sudden, that ridgeline just explodes. I mean, the earth shakes like an earthquake, even where I am. Pieces of steel half my size are flying across the top of our hill.
Wow.
I mean, it was just awesome. And, of course, fire and explosions and
mm-hmm.
rumbling. And they used to call them arc lights. That was the nickname for
mm-hmm.
them, because they just created this dramatic lightning-like light effect when they exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the time those bombs landed, those pilots had already turned their planes around to 30,000 feet and were heading back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how would you like to fight the war that way? You get in the plane, you fly 6 hours of total boredom, you drop your bombs, and then you fly 6 hours back to Guam, and then you do it again the next day.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they did. But, I mean, that was probably as close as friendlies got to a B-52 strike, and it just scared the living jeepers out of me. I couldn't imagine being a target of that
mm-hmm.
and surviving it and continuing to fight. I mean, it just, that would have sapped my resolve, I'm sure.
And around Quezon, that was daily.
Yeah. Yeah, and these guys, I mean, we just blew away that junk. Between the B-52 strikes and the Agent Orange,
mm-hmm.
that lovely, lush jungle around Quezon was turned brown. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
I told you I've read a lot of books.
Yes, sir.
I've developed a little pet point here I'm going to
mm-hmm.
unload on you. I think that in 1945, we made a crucial decision. Everybody knows that Ho Chi Minh asked us to help him, and the French were asking for our assistance in reestablishing their colony in Indochina.
Mm-hmm.
After the Japanese were defeated.
Sir, can I pause you just for a moment, please?
Sure. Harry Truman had to make it, but he was a brand new president, and Dean Acheson was Secretary of State, and he made that decision, and obviously he made the wrong one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not blaming him for anything, but it was obviously a crucial decision, and it's not hard to figure out why he would, instead of this funny-looking little yellow guy who called himself a communist,
mm-hmm.
decided to go with Charles de Gaulle and the French, because they were our allies. But that decision right there, as far as I'm concerned, cost millions of lives. Later, a couple years later, Acheson was still Secretary of State
mm-hmm.
when the communists took over China. And the Democrats, subsequent to that, were always taken to task by the Republicans for having lost China. That haunted the Democrats, and I think, and there are plenty of people who agree with me, I know, that was one of the reasons that JFK and subsequently LBJ couldn't extract themselves from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
JFK could not afford to be the president that lost Southeast Asia to the commies after they lost China to the commies.
Yes, sir.
And LBJ didn't want to be the first president to lose a war. Mm-hmm. And so despite the fact that both of them decided early on that they couldn't win the war, JFK decided that in 63 and said he would get out after the election in 64 and his decisions in 48 and the Democratic Party's inability to do that. If you want to read books, my favorites are A.J. Lang.
Okay, this will end the interview with Mr. Tom Essinger. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.